Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name is David A. And I am an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th, 1967, and for this I am so thankful. And first of all, I want to thank whoever is responsible for allowing me to come and share me with you and you with me. And so we have a lot of time this afternoon, and we'll have a lot of fun if you want to have a lot of fun. When we get into our traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of times, a lot of our members, they say, oh, no, you know, good God, that's something else. But basically, one of the reasons is the fact that those who do that, believe it or not, and this is not inventory taking, is they're still miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they really don't enjoy what has brought all this about. And, you know, I love to go and look in there and see when the book came to Arkansas and things like that. And many members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're satisfied, a lot of us, in going to our meetings and coming a little ahead of time and then doing a few 12-step calls and then going out and eat ice cream, you know. God, if you don't have coffee at a meeting, you've got the most disgruntled folks in the world, and I can understand it. I do, because I love the coffee myself. And particularly, a drunk, if he's got a dollar in his pocket, and he owes that dollar, and he's promised someone he's going to pay that dollar the next morning at 8 o'clock, but if ice cream comes first, and it doesn't make a bit of difference. And you know, it's a funny thing. They talk about hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia. Have you ever seen them eat ice cream? They go in and they say, now I want nuts and I want every kind of sauce you got, four dips and everything else. And that's a drunk. And that's just the kind of folks we are. And so when we get into our traditions, you know, a lot of times, as I say, for some reason or other, whatever it may be, they feel rather uncomfortable. Now, before I start, and since this is on tape, I want to make sure it's on tape. And I think it is necessary that we have it on tape, that no one speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. No one has that right. No one has that authority. And no one has been delegated as such. We just merely share our experiences. And I hope that I share my experiences with you, and as a result of my life, as a result of the traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, or in any part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not our opinions, because let's share our experiences and not our opinions, because opinions kill people. And the most precious commodity that we've got to offer any human being that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous for the alcoholic is life itself. And you know, you get to playing around with people's heads, and in AA we talk about how many lives we save, but we don't talk about how many we've killed with misinformation, telling them things will happen to them. We don't know it'll happen to them, you know. And hey, everybody's got the freedom to be ourselves as we are. Now, many, every meeting, and we hear it on a daily basis, and we hear it, read it a lot of times, and Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism, which is nothing more than a combination of Tradition 1 and 5. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Tradition 3. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting to our own contributions. Tradition 7. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Tradition 6. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Tradition 10. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Tradition 5. And so, you know, every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that comes to AA today is given three legacies. In the first legacy, it wasn't that way when AA first started, and it wasn't that way until our traditions were adopted, in 1950, basically, although they were written in the 40s by Bill, and at the first International Convention in Cleveland in 1950. And then later in 1955 at the International Convention, then our third legacy was adopted. Although the General Service Conference, basically on an experimental basis for the first 4 to 5 years, was in 1951. And so every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that comes to, or every alcoholic who comes to AA rather today is given three legacies as a gift. And the first legacy is recovery. And the second legacy is unity, or our traditions. And the third legacy is service, which basically is the authorization and creation of our General Service Conference. And then after that, why the 12 concepts were written. Over 12 concepts for our world service. And so, when we come to AA, and a lot of them, you know, and so the second legacy are unity, our traditions, and in AA we hear it all the time, and it's read how it works, but the traditions we have come to find out why it works. And also, we're going to have most of the afternoon to do this, and so if there's any questions that any of you would like to ask, feel free to do it. There is no question that's too little or too insignificant to anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though you may feel that it may be, you know, controversial in nature or whatever it is, but you have to remember, we are controversial in nature, period. That's the reason we're here. You know? That's the reason we're here. We're here because nobody else wanted us. That's the reason why. And AA got started because nobody wanted them drunks. And they found out if they could want each other, then they could spread this message to those that nobody wanted. We're kind of like the unwashed, you know. And this is about the way it is. And so very implicitly and throughout AA's traditions is the admission that our fellowship has its defects. And the reason for it, because it's composed of nothing but 100% defects, you know. And we're not here because of, you know, we're not brothers of virtue. We're brothers of defects of character and our willingness to have them removed under the power and love and guidance of a power greater than ourselves. So when you've got a fellowship that's composed of 100% of sick people, you know, with all our little petty grievances and our resentments and our hates and our angers and our feeling sorry for ourselves and boo-hoo, then it spreads into the fellowship. And so we admit that we not only have character defects as a society, but that these defects threaten us continuously. So our traditions are a guide to better ways of working and living, and they're also the medicine for our various group sicknesses. And don't kid yourself that groups don't get sick. Oh, they get sick. Whole groups get drunk. You know, one of the early days of AA, there was a group which is now formed out in Southern California, and the first group out there, and they didn't have about 12, 14, 15 members, and they got a call from a gal, and she's out there in one of them tourist courts. Now, that dates me, you know. And so they didn't have any women in AA, so one of them volunteered to go. Well, he never come back, so they went out to check on him. Well, he enjoyed her company so much, he started drinking with her, you know. And so they sent a third one out there, and he didn't come back. So they sent another one, and all three of them were drunk. The fourth one never come back. And then finally, the whole group went, the whole group got drunk. And they all got sober together. And that's how they got basically the first gal sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in Lower California. You know, and nobody wanted her, and they're the only ones that joined in with her, so she had no choice but to pick up her mattress and go with them, you know, and that's the way it was. And so as a result of it, you know, and the groups get sick. They get real sick. They get to arguing about money, and they get to arguing about, you know, if you got to have a smoke eater. And then they got to argue. One of the worst arguments I've ever been in a group was if they're going to move the telephone from that wall over to this wall. And, you know, and that's how new groups get started. And, you know, when you got two cats fighting, all you're going to have is more kittens. That's the way it works in AA, and that's how we spread. And so the 12 traditions are to group survival and harmony. What AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight at many of our individual defects. For by practical application, they ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. They ask us never to use the AA name in any quest for personal power or distinction of money. And the traditions guarantee the equality of all members and the independence of all groups. Thank God that AA is all inclusive and not exclusive. And each group has the freedom to be itself as it is, just like every member of Alcoholics Anonymous is given. After sobriety, we are given the greatest freedom as a human being that the world has ever known. And we can be ourselves as we are. Before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I almost died drunk. People would say, why don't you be like your daddy, like your mama, like your brother, like your neighbor, like your enemy, like this, that. And the harder I tried, the worse it got. And the worse it got, the harder I tried. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, David, you don't have to be like anybody else. Just be your stinking, rotten, sober self. And I said, you kidding? And they said, no. Because in AA, nobody can punish you. Nobody can sentence you. Nobody can make you do penance. Nobody can force you to believe anything. If you don't drink alcohol one day at a time, and you say you're a member, you're it. That's all there's to it. And that's almost impossible to believe. Because out there in that world out there, they don't operate that way. And after we get sober in AA, we can't stand that freedom. We want to change it. We want to put rules and regulations, who can belong, who can't belong, you know. Whether they're polka dotted, whether they're straight, whether they're crooked, whether they're gay, whether they're half and half, or whatever it is, you know, whether they're closeted, uncloseted, rooftops, where, don't make no difference. Everybody's got to start doing a little picking. We can't stand the freedom to be ourselves, or to let anybody else be ourselves. And so they ask us never to do those things. Because they show us, the traditions also show us how we can best relate ourselves to each other and to the outside world. And the traditions also indicate how we can best function in harmony as a great whole, and so for the sake of the welfare of our entire society, the traditions just simply ask, pardon me, that every member, every group, every district, every area, every region, every country in AA shall lay aside all desires, ambitions, and unwanted actions that could bring among us a serious division or lose from us the confidence of the world at large. Many, many members do not realize how well AA is respected. Maybe that is Alcoholics Anonymous and what it stands for. Maybe some of our members are not well respected in the world, but then after all, you know, we're not saints. And as a result of it, back in the old days, when the United Nations moved from San Francisco to its present site, and United Nations headquarters in New York City, why, one of the first ones to address the United Nations was former President Herbert Hoover. And he got up, and for 20 minutes, he talked to them about the United Nations and the conditions in the world. And he also, but for most of the 20 minutes, he spoke to the United Nations on the subject about, he found that there was a fellowship with a set of principles. And the fellowship was called Alcoholics Anonymous. And if the world would live by the principles that AA has for its recovery program and its fellowship and its philosophy, that the world would be the finest place in the world to live in. Now, this is back in the days when television was in its infancy, and most of the communication media in the world in those days was radio, and there's always a bunch of drunks that are sitting around doing nothing, buying railroads and airlines and all this and all that, and they were listening to the radio. And they said, you'd hear what that man just said, Herbert Hoover? Why, he was telling the United Nations that this would be the greatest world to live in if the world would live by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, well, we're the only one. Let's go up and tell Bill. And back when Bill was alive, they'd go to Bill for everything. And so they borrowed somebody else's car. They borrowed some money to put gas in somebody else's car. They borrowed some money for some cigarettes. And off they went up to Westchester County, up to Bedford Hills. And they come running in there, and Bill was back in his little house where he used to do his writing, and they ran up there, and they were wild-eyed looking. And Bill says, "What's up, boys?" And meanwhile, the story had changed from the time they'd left downtown New York till they got up there to Bedford Hills. You know, us drunks, we don't lie. We just embellish a little bit. And they said, "Bill, old Herbert." Now, he went from former President Herbert Hoover to old Herbert. Old Herbert was down there at the United Nations, and he was telling them that, by God, if the world didn't live by them, the world would blow up. Bill said, "Live by what?" He said, "The principles of AA." And Bill, we're the only ones that know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill and Anna knew Bill and met Bill and heard Bill. And he was a real drunk. Yeah, I mean, a real drunk. And smoke, you talk about now I'm going to tell you something. He had a real alcoholic smoker's cough. One of them kind that would start at your toenails and come all the way up. And you'd have an aftershock for 5 minutes, you know, just gone, 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 gone. And old Bill with that long turkey neck of his and smoking them cigarettes, and he even got excited. He said, "Well, Bill, guess what? If we're asked to run the world, we're the only ones who know anything about AA, and we're going to be in striped breeches, and we're going to be in swallowtail coats and them celluloid collars, you know, with them wings turned up. We'll be riding around in them big limousines with flags on the front, having diplomatic immunity. We can park in front of fire plugs and speed all we want to. Go to red lights and everything." And Bell's, he got excited. "Can't you just see a bunch of drunks running the United Nations, you know? And you turn on your television in the morning, and this announcer comes on, and he's in shadow. He said, "Good morning, world. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And we're down here at the United Nations, and we're going to open this meeting this morning with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. And for you civilians who don't know the Serenity Prayer, the words will come along the bottom of the screen, and y'all say it with me. And after the Serenity Prayer, we're going to read a portion of Chapter 5, How It Works. And the ambassador from Russia is still having a tough time understanding it, so we're going to ask him to read a portion of Chapter 5, How It Works. And then on the agenda today will be honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And we be sure and return to this television station at 5 o'clock for a very important news announcement. Because we understand confidentially that the ambassador from Iran is going to take his fifth step with the ambassador from Iraq, you know. And then Bill said, wait a minute, boys, wait a minute. They estimated about that time how many millions of alcoholics had in the world, 9.5 million, 12, you know. They're kind of like AA membership, you know. And we're kind of like the Baptist church, you know. Once we get on the rolls, you never get off, you know. Whether you're a sinner, saved sinner, died sinner, or flying sinner, don't make no difference. But in AA, we don't keep those kind of records because we really don't know. We really don't know. When the sun went up all over the world this morning, a lot of members are sober in AA. But when the sun goes down at 5 o'clock this evening all over the world, a lot of them that woke up this morning, the members of AA, won't be members of AA. That's how little we know about stopping drinking. You know? And so Bill got excited. He said, wait a minute, boys. He says, "You know what?" He said, "We're not all things for all people. We've got all we can do to take care of our own kind." And so the 12 traditions, and I'll tell you another experience of how the world and what the world thinks about us, the heads of states and governments. At the World Service Meeting, which was held in 1982 in Mexico City, outside of Mexico City, and I've had the wonderful experience of being your delegate to the World Service Meetings, and the one in 1982 in San Juan del Rio, Mexico, and in this last October, this past October in New York City. We have it every 2 years. And every fourth year, it's back in the United States. And every other fourth year, it's outside of the North American continent. And so, delegates from all over the world attend that have a service structure. And as a result, when it was announced it was going to be in Mexico, one morning, our general manager received a transatlantic cable call, a telephone call from South Africa. And the two would-be delegates from South Africa were on the phone explaining to our general manager that they would not be able to attend the World Service meeting in Mexico because South Africa and Mexico did not have diplomatic relations due to their political climate that they have down there. And they wouldn't be able to come. And while this conversation was going on, we had a visitor in the office, a member of AA, and Bob saw him. He said, and he listened to this conversation as after it was over with, why this member asked Bob what's going on, and Bob explained to him about the fact of the World Service meeting. And these two delegates called about their concern that they could not come because of different, they couldn't get in. And that's all Bob said. And the member said, thank you for sharing this thing with me, and he left. And he went back to his job. Well, he happened to be the second highest ranking paid permanent employee of the United Nations. And he went immediately to the ambassador to the United Nations from Mexico, and he walked in and he said, you know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You ought to know. Because we got that dingy son of yours sober and straight when nobody else wanted to fool with him. And he said, you know, we got this World Service meeting in Mexico City, and we're not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization. And our two delegates that would normally come to that from South Africa can't come in because they can't clear immigration. You have no diplomatic relations. He said, now I want you to call down there and get that thing straightened out. He said, well, I'll have to call what corresponds to your Secretary of State in the United States. He said, well, call him. He did. And the ambassador explained to the Secretary of State of Mexico what the situation was. He said, oh, wait a minute. This will have to either take, it'll have to go before the, what we correspond, the Mexican legislature, or a presidential order. And he said to him, well, at least see what the president of Mexico will do. It's urgent. So the secretary of the state of Mexico, whatever it is, he got a hold of Portillo, and he told Portillo the situation. Portillo picked up the telephone, and he called his friend, and he says, friend, this is Portillo. Are you still connected with that AA business? Well, the gentleman that he called is a lawyer, perhaps one of the outstanding international lawyers in the world, a non-alcoholic, who at that time and who still is the chairman of the board of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous of Mexico. Now, this non-alcoholic, he met another world-famous international lawyer at an international lawyers convention in London, who started talking to him about that he was involved with this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and has been since the early 40s. A gentleman by the name of Bernard Smith, who was perhaps one of the best world international lawyers, chairman of the board of one of the largest banks in the world, a lawyer and also was a longtime chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous of our country, of North America, and the old Alcoholic Foundation. In fact, Bernard Smith did most of the legal work for our entity and also our incorporation and bylaws, etc., 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 and had a lot to do with basically checking out the 12 concepts that Bill wrote and several other things. And so this lawyer in Mexico became interested in Alcoholics Anonymous, what it would do for a human being. And he came back and he offered his services. Now, at that time, they didn't have any non-alcoholic trustees on the General Service Board of Mexico. And he became one of the first and chairman. And so Portillo said, are you still interested? And he says, well, sure. He says, well, why didn't you call me about? He says, you know what I think about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, it is the only freedom that the people in this country have. Or anywhere else. He said, nobody can touch them. Why didn't you tell me? Well, it was at the time, you know, when they devaluated the peso and they had closed the banks and they had troops running around there with guns and everything else. He said, I didn't want to bother you in any time. He said, hang up the phone. He got his Secretary of State in there, and he says, we have diplomatic relations with Holland. Have them two drunks. It'll be there. Have them fly to Amsterdam. Let them clear immigration in Amsterdam and come directly to Mexico City. Well, I don't know if any of y'all been down there lately, but you don't just walk into your terminal like you do here off the airplane in Little Rock. They put you on one of them buses way out there somewhere, and they bring you in, and you're in a sterile area. Nobody is between you and immigration, and nobody is between you after you lose immigration customs except folks got guns on. And them two drunks get off of that thing in this sterile area, and there are three drunks there with signs on them, World Service Meeting. And they ran up to them and hugged them, and they said, come with us. No, we don't go here. We go down here. They went down there, and they doing all the talking in Spanish, and they told them, here they are. And they said, where are your papers? Give them to them. Boom, they didn't even look at them. And they took them right through customs, and that's how they got into Mexico City. Well, when the World Service Meeting's over, them two drunks from South Africa got word, could they get out, you know? And so, one of them, he's blacker than his face, but he was not black. He was a Muslim. The second oldest living, continued sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in South Africa. And in AA, we have no color line. And so the same three drunks that brung them in there took them back through the same process, stayed in the sterile area until they left. Now, that's what heads of state think about Alcoholics Anonymous. Heads of state in the Soviet bloc are beginning to ask a lot of questions about Alcoholics Anonymous. Particularly when they found out that atheists in Alcoholics Anonymous can stay sober. Agnostics can stay sober. That you don't have to believe anything. You don't have to do anything. You can drink if you want to. You ain't even a member anymore. And it leaves it up to the individual's innermost consciousness of basic human integrity and honesty in the fiber of a human being. And that is perhaps the reason that AA is the only free fellowship that's left in the world today for an alcoholic. And so the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous stand as a sacrificial character of our life together and the greatest force of unity that we know. Tradition 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Probably no society, no fellowship in this world sets a higher value on the personal welfare of the individual member than does Alcoholics Anonymous. But long ago we found that the common welfare had to come first. For without it, there would be very little personal welfare. I'll ask you one question. How can we be free people in AA if our fellowship isn't allowed to stay to leave us free? Free of alcohol and in a way to be free of self. That's a tremendous freedom. Our individual sobriety depends upon the group, and the group depends upon us, and that's live and let live. And so unless we curb our individual desires and ambitions, we can damage what? The common welfare of the group. I'm going to give you two practical examples. I've been involved with all of them. One of them is a noisy, wet drunk. And today in AA, we don't see this as often as we used to, and I don't know the reason, and maybe it's good. But you don't see it anymore. There are a lot of groups in Alcoholics Anonymous, after they get sober, ain't seen a wet, sloppy, falling out of his chair drunk, drugged to a meet, you know. And I'll tell you, your group hadn't lived till you got one of them in there. And they used to bring them and put them on the front row. And they'd sit there and hold him there to keep him sliding out the chair, you know. And then they'd tell whoever's talking that night, well, we got a new wet one and he's going to be on the red road. And you talk to him, they'd instruct you what to tell him, you know. And you ain't live till they fall out and they burn up the rugs, you know. And I kind of like that because then you know it's there. The rug is there for what it's supposed to be there for, you know, and mess up everything. And you up there talking. I don't know if you ever been there and you're in a group and
Somebody's up there telling their story about drinking, you know, and how they drank for 45 years and then burn up the cars and lost an arm and shot their wife and dog and kid. And then one day they woke up and realized they had a problem with alcohol, you know. And they talk about blackouts. The thing that amazed me about a drunk when he tells his story, he talks about them blackouts. How come we can remember it so well to tell her is the thing that amazes me. And this wet drunk said, wait a minute, you don't know nothing about drinking. Let me tell you about drinking. And somebody said, shut up. You know how a wet drinking drunk answers you when you tell him, shut up, make me. Somebody said, we said, shut up. He said, I said, make me. And somebody back in the room said, you can't talk to that brother drunk like that. He's an alcoholic. And the other one said, shut up. You don't know the difference between chicken salad and a turkey. And that's exactly what that wet drunk wants. Somebody is making a fuss over him. You know. They're arguing with each other because he just come from someplace where they're arguing with him. And if there's anything a wet drunk will do to you, if you make a 12-step call, if he finds a crack in your armor, he'll eat you up alive. And then the members got to arguing about can he stay, can't he stay, all this. And sometimes they get into fights and arguments, and sometimes the wet drunk gets very, very belligerent. And sometimes they have to call the police, and sometimes they ask him to leave. But they bring him back when he is in better shape to hear what? To hear the message. Because, you see, in that meeting, just like right in this meeting right now, there's always someone with a concrete block in their belly so big, they're fighting a drink, they're fighting living in this world sober, and they're dying for somebody to talk with them. And everybody just rushes by, it goes off, you know. And so, every member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the common welfare is for every member who comes there. And so what are we doing? We bring that wet drunk back when they're in better shape to hear the message, for we're putting the common welfare first, but it is his welfare too. If he is ever going to get sober, for the group must still go on functioning, whether he or she gets sober, whether they leave, whether they stay, ready for him and others to come. And yet that's only one rare aspect of the problem. And when we get sober in AA, we begin to throw off a few small bits of that big ego, and we admit, well, I can't handle alcohol, but I can't stay away from it on my own. Fine. But then we find that there's still plenty of this ego. Sometimes it leads us into taking other members' inventories or gossip about their supposed shortcomings. I guess I'm the only member of AA in this meeting this afternoon that's guilty of that, you know. And it may lure some into hogging the discussion at every discussion meeting, you know. And, you know, I quit going to the old side group. Old so-and-so is getting up there and they're reading the preamble, they're reading the preface, they're saying the serenity prayer, they're introducing the speaker, and they're always making a talk, and they're closing it with the Lord's prayer, they're even taking up the money. And I'm tired of going to that deal. Every time they're up, I told you, see them up there. Well, you know how to avoid that? Simple. If you're asked to do anything in AA and you turn it down, don't gripe at the ones that are doing it. That's how simple that whole deal is. Somebody's going to have to do it. And then you got the other one that even you volunteer won't even let you do it. We'll get into that too, you know. And so, as a result, and then when we slip in that spot and we get to start criticizing, somebody, well, you know, they criticize, well, this is a selfish program. You know, we got the greatest answers in the world. You know, it's selfish programming. Don't take my inventory. And here's the grace one. Some are sicker than others. Sure are, aren't we? Yeah. And say, well, why don't we indulge ourselves into this little bit of fun? Well, we all know the good reason why we shouldn't, because indulge in this kind is an immediate personal danger. Because what? It threatens the individual's own sobriety, but more serious. It threatens the very basis of our sobriety. It's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and an AA group. I have to ask myself all the time, how come I have been so fortunate? Because when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only other place that I could be a member of was locked up for the rest of my life in a penitentiary. are in an insane asylum. And in the free world, to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to come and go, that's the basis of where I found my sobriety and a way to live it. And that is the AA group. Because self-righteous gossip can and will damage a mutual trust is vital to every group. The compulsive talker can ruin an effective discussion meeting. Now, back in the old days, and we don't really hear it so much anymore, I guess maybe there is, I really don't know, maybe I'm not looking for it. Back in the old days, they didn't have any women, ladies in AA. And I like to call them ladies. Women, you know, Anna included. And so, I've known her a long time. And, you know, and they didn't have it, the opposite sex. And so, and you know, they didn't. And when the first one come to Alcoholics Anonymous, my God, they said, it's going to ruin AA. That no woman was an alcoholic, you know, she had problems other than alcohol, you know. And she wasn't a real alcoholic. And so as a result of it, well, when the first one to get sober was a gal by the name of Florence Rankin. She got sober before Marty did. And old Florence, she come into AA about the time when they were writing the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they hadn't named it yet. They didn't know what to name it. And they were sitting around writing one chapter and sending it out to Akron for their changes and backwards and forwards. And they got down to where it was pretty getting close, put the book out. Florence come in there and they were arguing one night about what they're going to call the book. And they had a drunk that was very active in those days by the name of Fitz Mayo. And he lived in Baltimore originally, and he's close, knew everything in Washington, so... They said, why don't you go down when you're in Washington, go in the Library of Congress? And they thought they were going to call it a way out. And so he goes and he sends a telegram back and he says, there are 12 already in the Library of Congress with that name. And the drunk says, no, that would make 13 and that would be unlucky. Then they thought they were going to call it the Grapevine. And the FBI got wind of it because the FBI puts out a journal called The Grapevine. And the FBI didn't want no part of AA, and AA didn't want no part of the FBI. So you say, well, we got The Grapevine. That's true. And you know how they allowed it to happen? They were perfectly happy. It's called the Alcoholics Anonymous Grapevine Incorporated, period. And as long as they put them two AAs and what it spelled for and stood for, the FBI was real happy about the situation. And so, anyway, and then they decided they were going to call it the First 100 Men. Originally, the corporation, which is now Works Publishing Company, and then later became Works Publishing Incorporated, which is now AAWS Incorporated. Originally, it was a 100 Men incorporation, and it was going to be a Delaware corporation for the first 100 men who supposedly got sober and alcoholics. None. They were going to call it the Book of 100 Men. And Florence had one of them women alcoholic fits. She jumped up and started screaming and hollering, you're not going to call it the 100 men, you're going to call it 100 men and a woman. And they said, no, that'll make the title too long. She said, I demand a vote for the group conscience. They did. I'd guess the 18, 19 there, 17 voted against her. She's the only one that voted for it. And they said, and then one night, they still hadn't named the book. And AA then is like AA today. We got members who think that AA will cure everything in this world. You know, backaches, headaches, falling out hair, you name it. So there was, one of them had a friend that had a lot of money. But the problem was he was locked up for the rest of his life in a nut house as a pure nut. Insane. So they got permission to bring him out to this meeting hoping that maybe he would hear something that would unscramble his brain. And it, you know, and so they brought him in and they were arguing about it and they told him to go sit in the corner over there. And they're arguing about what to call the book and he's over there mumbling and somebody says, shut up. And another said, wait a minute, listen to what he's mumbling. You know what he's mumbling? Anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic. Now, in Cleveland, in the Akron-Cleveland area, they had already been using that name. This is before the book came out. But not as Alcoholics Anonymous, as an anonymous group of alcoholics. Now, where this gentleman, without a full string of lights, had heard about it, no one knew. But that's what he's mumbling. And one of them says, wait a minute, Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're getting good before you get well in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't get too spiritual. Stop and realize that where we got our name from, it came from a nut. You see, ours is a total synthetic recovery program and synthetic fellowship, because it came from everywhere. And we just got it down to where we understand it and to where we can communicate it. Nothing has been invented in Alcoholics Anonymous. And not even one day at a time. Because that had been used a long time ago, and if one really wants to understand the one day at a time living, and I suggest you can find it as Bill sees it, and it has to do with our emotional being as a human being one day at a time. And so that's how the book got named. But they still were having problems, you know, and back in A, and they used to call it Red Riding Hood and Wolf. And you have to remember, and there was a gal by the name of Gladys Barm, and Gladys was a heck of a gal. And Gladys got sober right about the same time Marty did, maybe a little early. And she later moved to Dallas, was a member of the group that I'm still a member of, and a great gal, and evidently at one time she had been a show gal or something. And she, in Philadelphia, the group got started this way, the first group. There was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who is, I guess, is responsible for more alcoholics being free to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous than any member that's ever lived. And he was an atheist. His name was Jimmy Burwell. And Jimmy Burwell would go to their meetings in New York in the 38s and the 39s before the book come out, and they'd get to talking about, they didn't have anything like chapter 5, and they didn't know what to read. They'd just read something, what they thought would be spiritual. Talking about God, and Jimmy would just literally have a fit. And he said, I don't want to hear it. I'm a sober member of AA. And by God, I just don't like to hear this God business. Now, he's the one that was responsible raising so much Cain that the word God, as we understand him, were put in the steps. And Jimmy is the one that forced Bill to do that. But before that, Jimmy would raise so much Cain at the group, it'd disrupt the meetings. So the group would call everybody but him and tell him where they're going to meet, and he never could find the group. But the problem is they were running out of places to meet to hide from Jimmy. Well, they went to Bill and they said, we got to get rid of Jimmy. He's just raised 9 kinds of Cain. And Bill and Dr. Bob formed an automobile polish company. And they put Jimmy on the road selling it, and they made him sales manager of a one-man sales force of automobile polish that they never was going to manufacture to begin with, but just to get him out on the road. So he gets about 90 miles away from New York City, Philadelphia, and he does what any good sober drunk needs to do. He goes and gets him a wet drunk, and he starts talking to him. And guess what? This drunk took the bait. So there started a group. You have to remember the group. When two or more alcoholics are gathered together for sobriety, they may call themselves an AA group, provided they are self-supporting through their own contributions and have no outside affiliation. And so they start this little group in Philadelphia. And they used to put a blurb in the newspaper. They said, if you have a problem with alcohol and you want to get fixed, they call it fixing drunks in them days. Sort of like veterinarians, you know. And you want to do something about it, get fixed. This meeting meets here, and it was in a hotel. They put it in the newspaper. And they used to have, at that meeting, in those days, they used to have a guard outside the door. They'd lock the door to close meeting. And so only real alcoholics could come to the meeting. And in comes old Gladys into that hotel, and she's just drunker than an $8 bill. And she has on one of them flapper dresses. She used to be a show gal, and she had a little hat with a feather up the top of one of them, they say a half net across here. And I've met some of the people that knew that. And And with them fishnet hose and them spiked heels and them thongs wrapped around her ankles and just drunker than a billy goat. With a big old purse, and she comes a-reeling in there, and she's got this little piece of paper out of the newspaper, and this man says, "What do you want?" And she said, "Is this where you fix drunks?" He said, "You go over there." And she said, "What's over there?" "That's where them others meet." Well, in them days, they didn't call it Al-Anon, you know, and the only reason a lot of the drunks could get to meetings is because of the wives were the only ones that were working, and the only ones that had any money and could drive. And so, they used to meet over there and have a meeting over there, and that's it, you know. And he said, "You go over there with them." And she said, "No, I got trouble with alcohol, and I want to get sober, and I want to get fixed." He said, "You go over there." And she said, "Are you a phony or something? Who's meeting in there?" And he said, "Alcoholics." She said, "I'm one, and I'm going in there. You said I could come." He says, "No, go over there." With that, she reached down and took off one of them spiked heel shoes. And she started beating on that drunk and darn near beat him to death. And finally, when he got a breath or two and one eye was still open, he says, "Well, if you feel that way about it, go in." Of course, he had no choice. He's going to kill him. Well, that alcoholic happened to be Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie Thatcher was our co-founder, Bill's friend and sponsor. He's the one that carried the message to Bill. And Ebbie later became Gladys's sponsor. But to go back in a lot of groups, and you know, when AA spread out of the New York area and out of Akron and start spreading everywhere, and it got down to our part of the country, well, a lot of the groups were meeting in, you know, in Catholic churches and basements of Episcopal churches and you know, and a lot of the, of course, you know what the church is in our country, that's the Southern Baptist Church. And they ain't got no alcoholics in the Southern Baptist Church. And in the small towns, they didn't have any Catholic churches, so naturally, they got them an old abandoned storefront or an upstairs loft somewhere, and it started to be the meeting place, and then they come to the clubhouse, and some of the ladies made curtains, and then later on, they moved to another place, and they put a sandbox out in the back for the kids to play in, and then they'd have suppers on Saturday night, and spaghetti suppers, and cakes, and ice creams, and it sort of became a social gathering along with it, other than a meeting. And that's how it spread in our part of the country. And so they're commonly known as AA clubs, although there's no such thing as an AA club. But the lingo is that's the way it is. And so back in those days, and naturally, and there was a group in where I come from, it's one of them silk stocking groups. And God almighty, and they had what's known as what they call Red Riding Hood wolves, you know, hen and shin or whatever you want to call it. And they had a bunch, you know, that were getting good for to get well, you know. And the kind, you know, that they come in and they quit drinking and they quit cussing and they quit smoking. And then they start jogging, you know. I've never been arrested for fat driving. I don't know about anybody else. And, you know, they get good before they get well. And they got a little upset because they had a few of them over there goo-goo-eyeing at each other. And so they said, "They're running our reputation. We got to get rid of them." Well, you can't run anybody out of a group, you know. And so they didn't know what to do, so they sat down and they wrote a letter to Bill, and they said, he's the head horse. Said, "Dear Bill, we've got these people in our group, and they're doing this, and they're doing that, and they're ruining the reputation of our group. How do you get rid of them?" Bill wrote back, "Dear group, are they staying sober? Love, Bill." Well, this bunch says, "Bill, something wrong with Bill. He really doesn't understand what we're trying to tell him." So they wrote a more detailed letter. They didn't know what they were doing, but they wanted to get rid of them. That's what you call an obsession of the mind. In other words, there were a group of people that were trying to regulate who can and who can't come to their meetings or hang around the seat. And they were obsessed with it. And so they wrote a more detailed letter, and Bill wrote back to their group, "We're still staying sober." They said, "Well, something's wrong with Bill." So they sat down and wrote a really detailed letter, really just on purpose. They embellished it quite a bit to get them out of there. And they sent an airmail special delivery, certified return receipt requested. And the letter came back and said, "Dear group, are they still staying sober? Don't bother me anymore. Love, Bill." Well, guess what happened? That group was so busy writing letters and waiting for the answer, they forgot to look over there. And when they looked over there, guess what? The situation had taken care of itself. And I am so thankful that was shared with me in my first 5 or 6 years of sobriety. I mean, weeks. Because at, right there then, I found out there that I had all I could do one day at a time to take care of my relationship with my Creator and quit worrying about what somebody else is doing. I remember that there used to be an old obnoxious, I thought he was obnoxious, big old fat old boy, and he'd aggravate everybody, and particularly the young ladies in the group, and not in a sex way, but just, you know, just ugly things to him, you know, and he just hated the opposite sex. And one day I said to one of them fellas that got sober, I believe, when Coolidge was president, I said to him, I said, how is he staying sober? He said, that's God's business. I said, what are you talking about? He said, my God, you don't believe it? You go in the kitchen and you look up and you ask God whose business that Dick's staying sober. I was bad to be around a bunch of folks that were bad to send me in a corner. But like I was a kid with a dunce cap on, you know, and like in school. And I went in the kitchen and I said, God, whose business is it that Dick's staying sober? And something in me said, listen, David, you've got all you can do to let me be God and you be David. And we'll get along real good. I come out there and old S.A. said, whose business is it that he said? I said, God's business. God's business. And those things were shared to me in very, very early in sobriety, you know. And so as a result, and then there was a couple, in another state. They'd work with this gal for God knows 20 some odd years. Ah, oh, she'd get sober 6 weeks and she'd go to drink. And she'd stay sober 9 months and go back to drinking. Never made a year a better news. Everybody had quit her, but this month they never gave up on her. And so finally, in desperation, they didn't know what to do, so they called up Bill Wilson and they said, Bill, we'd like to come up and visit with you. We've got a very important matter to talk over with you. And so they flew up to Bedford Hills and Bill greeted them and says, all right now. And they were both, the man and lady were both members of AA. And said, what is the problem? And they told him the problem about to have this gal, how everybody's worked with her, and they've been working with her for 20 years, and she's never been able to stay sober. And they said, Bill, what do you think? And Bill says, well, some do and some don't. And when that couple got back down to South Florida, they realized they paid for 2 round airplane tickets to hear Bill say, some do and some don't. And so as a result of it, you know, we find in AA we're not even having any more sex difficulties than any other societies, perhaps less, you know, for the size of our society. I guess AA is, if one would look at it realistically and honestly, and look back and see that families that have been brought back together, families that haven't been brought back together, but there is beginning to be communication between them, I guess that it has done more for family relations with separate but cooperating fellowships of Al-Anon and Alateen than any fellowship in the world has ever done. And when you start multiplying the number of people all over the world who have been affected by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if one does read the Al-Anon's tradition, their fifth tradition is threefold, and the third triad says this, that we practice the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, there's no such thing as 12 steps of Al-Anon. They're the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you say, well, it can't be. The 12th step is not worded like the 12th step of AA. It is, well, I got news for you. In the multi-lift copy of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous before the big book, the big red was printed, the first printing, the 12th step, you read, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And so when Bill was traveling around the country trying to sell the traditions to the groups, and he came, Lois asked him, how are the families doing? He said, they ain't doing too well. There's no communication. The alcoholic has found a spiritual way to grow, and the family's been relegated over there, maybe to bake cakes or something else to come along for the ride, and there's no communication. And he says, Lois, why don't you and Ann, now Ann was not Ann Smith, but a lady out in California, see what you can do about for the families, and that's how the family group got started, which is now known as Al-Anon. And she said, well, Bill, if we're going to have communication, will you loan us the 12 steps or give us the 12 steps? And he says, well, we borrowed from everything and everybody, and so they used basically what was in the multiple-list copy, and having had, which is then the step had been changed to having had a spiritual awakening in the 12 steps, and we tried to carry this message to others, and they eliminated, especially alcoholics. And so that's how that came about. And Al-Anon's fabulous success as it is today. And so we find, as I said before, that we're not having so, but, you know, but like other societies, we find among us forces that threaten us in ways that alcohol and sex could not, and money. These are the desires for power, for domination, for glory, and as I said, for money. They're all the more dangerous because they are invariably powered by self-righteousness, self-justification, and the destructive power of anger, which usually masquerades as righteous indignation. So pride, fear, and anger. That's not new in Alcoholics Anonymous. In a few days, we're going to celebrate the birthday of a man who talked this to his flock. He said, pride, fear, and anger. This is what kills people. And so we come to find in AA that pride, fear, and anger, these are the enemies of our common welfare. So for the purposes of AA's traditional principles is to bring these forces to the top and to keep them there. Only then can AA's common welfare be served, and only then can AA's unity become permanent. Because the preservation of AA's unity is not only a life or death matter for us, but also for the alcoholic who's still unrecovered. We're in here for that guy out there, or that guy. We're here for our sobriety. And if we don't stay sober, and if we don't have a group to where alcoholics out there can come in and get as good a break and benefit as you and I have got, then AA, something's going to happen to it that we wish that it didn't. But you see, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we also have some other things that are deterrent to that. Tradition 2, for our group purposes, but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience, our leaders are but trusted servants to do no government. Now, when this tradition first came out in the late 40s, and Bill, oh my God, the oldest member of the group, darn near had heart attacks. And they said that the ultimate authority in the group is me. My group ain't got no conscience. I'm the conscience of the group. And they got awful upset about it. And so those early AA members quickly recognized the power driver as a potential wrecker. And he or she is still around. The member who is always sure that he or she is always right. The member who is happily ready to assume all the burdens of leadership and grimly unwilling to share them, let alone give them up, and they don't, rotation is for them sick folks. I'm it. Look what I've done for you, and you're going to fold if you kick me out. But a group does need officers. How can we cope with this dilemma? Well, Tradition 2 provides the answer. Now, AA is both a democracy and, in the words of our co-founder Bill Wilson, a benign anarchy. A group elects its own officers who have no power to order anybody to do anything. So what's the big deal if you elected the group chairman? It ain't no big honor to be known as the head sick. That's the reason why every 6 months or whatever group does, they rotate it. They want everybody to have a chance of freedom to be the head sick. We don't want to let anybody suffer, you know. In most groups, most of the slate rotates out of office in the 6 months, and then they get new ones. And if a group wants to be a part of the worldwide AA service structure, then it elects a general service representative with a 2-year term that of service that corresponds to the same length and the servitude of the delegate. And also the district and DCMs and the area officers. GSRs elect the area committee members or district committee members. And then they join them in a lot of areas in electing a delegate from their area to the Annual General Service Conference. I suggest that sometime you pick up this and read it. There are many, many areas surrounding Arkansas that have adopted many of the things in here. We have in the Northeast Texas area.
Colorado has.
Quite a bit of it. You have to remember that Alcoholics Anonymous in Arkansas has been here a lot longer than it has been in a lot of other areas, believe it or not. And it's been here a long time. And so, and as a result, and then the area elects a delegate to the General Service Conference. And the conference is about the closest approximation, you can't call it a government, that AA has, because it produces opinions on important matters of policy. It approves the choices of some trustee nominees, which are Class A trustees, which are non-alcoholic trustees, general service trustees, and then directly elects others, such as your regional trustee, of which you have one that's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous of Arkansas, Wayne, who lives over at Rogers, Arkansas. And incidentally, I serve at the present time on the General Service Board, and with Wayne, and Wayne is a tremendously dedicated member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a member of the AAWS board. He goes in every month. In addition to the quarterly meetings, in addition to the week for the conference, and he's something else. And he's one of your products. He comes right out of his service structure. He's been hand-fed and had-fed, hadn't even, Anna? Right out of his structure. And he is tough as nails. But he's fair. And he's doing a tremendous job. And I'm not telling you that because I'm here. Because, you see, the reason I know he's doing a tremendous job because I taught him everything he knew. I had to unscrew everything Anna did. Yeah, and so we have a lot of fun. In fact, I talked to him the other day. And, you know, and he's doing a tremendous job. And we've been on committees together, and so and I happen to be, I'm a trustee at large. Now, really, if you read the service manual, it's very, very frustrating. You don't know who I am or what I am, but I'm just there, you know. But neither the conference nor the board can give orders to any AA group or member. And then you say, well, who's in charge around here? Well, AA is a spiritual principle fellowship. And so the ultimate authority is the spiritual concept of the group conscience. Its voice is heard when a well-informed group gathers together to arrive at a decision. And it results more, not as much on arithmetic or a yes or no count. Minority ideas get very thoughtful attention in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I have a suggestion to offer any member of Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of my own experience, if you feel in your group, if you feel in your district, if you feel in AA as a whole, that you're uncomfortable with any sort of a decision, any sort of a policy, anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a suggestion. Don't carry it around and let it eat you up like a cancer and start criticizing other people, because when we criticize other people, all we're telling somebody we're hurting. Stand up and say, this is the way I feel. And you'd be surprised how many others feel the same way. Because, you see, one of the defects of character is we don't want to hurt people's feelings. And yet, who's hurting the most? You see, this is the freedom I'm talking about. And then who can say, run you off? If they say, shut up, you say, by whose authority? And they have no defense. They have no defense. That is in an AA group or AA structure. What about that annoying character who's always sure he's right? You better listen. This time they could be right. If they're wrong, then they will remember the first tradition as well as the second, go along with the decision of the group conscience. Does this notion seem cloudy? Well, let's think back to our first AA meeting. The presence us newcomers felt in those rooms was the same as a group conference. It was real. They welcomed us in. They didn't set up any barriers. They didn't set up any rules. They didn't set up any regulations. Well, you're going to say, well, where does AA get its direction? Who runs it? And this is a puzzler for every newcomer who comes to Alcoholics. Now, you mean you don't have any presidents? You don't have any senators? No, all we just got just drunks. That's all. And as a result of it, nobody can compel, as I said before, you can to pay any dues. no board of directors who can cast one of our erring brothers or sisters out to Siberia somewhere. And the outside world looks at us and members look at this can't be so. There has to be a hidden gimmick somewhere. Then they ask to an experienced AA member if this tradition works, and this member says, you're darn right that it works. Well, as a result of it, it was all brought about by AA's experience. Now, does AA really does have real leadership? Sure it does. Most emphatically, yes. Because as a result of it, it comes about as a result of experience. We uncover our true leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous through the committee system in AA. That's how it comes about. Not through appointments, not through personality, not because somebody's a glib, silver-tongued talker. But it comes as a result of people who have become to live the program. And when they get up, they talk fact, they share experience and not opinion, and the members are willing to walk with them and follow. You see, in AA, the reason that we operate the way we do is real simple. It's because we don't like to be ordered around to do nothing. You can't tell a drunk nothing. That's the reason why we're experts on nothing. So we don't like to be hollered at, we don't like to be screamed at, we don't like to be told what to or what not to do. And so as a result of it, this is one of the greatest spiritual concepts that we have. And I'm going to spend a few moments on three, and then let's have a break if you want to ask questions, and then we'll have coffee, and then we'll go on because this is a goodie. And we're going to talk about them pure addicts, quote, quote. We're going to talk about them half and half, quote, quote. We're going to talk about, you know, dual problems, triple problems, quadruple problems, and that long lost soul, the pure alcoholic with no problems. Well, you know, tradition three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Now, I'm going to be very serious for a few moments. And one thing. Now, we have to remember that in this tradition, it says the only requirement for AA, we have to remember now the name of our fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous. We also have to remember that members of Alcoholics Anonymous were, are, and will always be, unless it's changed, have been, are, and will always be alcoholics, even though we may have other problems. And so the other problems naturally come about in our talks, in our own personal experience. You see? And so the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Now, it's very obvious that if you ain't ever drunk alcohol, then what's the desire to stop drinking it? Now, we're not talking about Welch's grape juice when to stop drinking in AA, you know. And so in AA, the best way to do this whole deal is this. We really don't have to be concerned. The agent that brings us here will force us to stay or it'll eliminate us, one of the two. You know? And I don't care how a drunk gets to AA. If he's shot out of a cannon, if he's barbed wired and trussed and thrown in here, it don't make any difference to me. What you want to do after you get here, that's all. And so we haven't are still very concerned about our membership. In fact, when strong and heavy publicity first came AA's way, even today, when there's more publicity about alcoholism than ever before, many groups, and it's only natural, they become scared, and they say, won't all kinds of odd people show up? They'll have complications, alcohol mixed with pills and other things. And you know what? Every kind of showed up. They certainly have. In the older days, and even today, they talk about that mystical character called a pure alcoholic. No complications. You understand? Just a guzzler. Well, many who come to AA actually thought they were like that themselves. And therefore, when the members begin pouring in, then they've got to worrying about, won't there be some mighty odd people? Won't there be criminals? Won't there be social undesirables and degenerates? And that's nothing more than snobbishness and smugness, basically brought around by the innate fear of human beings. And you know, we simply did not know, do not know who's going to show up. And you know what, since A's inception, every kind of a human being that's an alcoholic have found their way into AA. You say, well, isn't every organization entitled to a rule for membership? Why did AA decide to forego this privilege? To be all-inclusive and not exclusive. And that's easy. Early members tried it the other way. It didn't work. And so as our fellowship was nearing its 10-year mark, the office which at that time served as the general service or as the world headquarters in those days, asked all the groups that were in correspondence to list their rules for membership and send them in. And they did. And if all the rules that were sent in were been enforced in AA everywhere, it would have been impossible for any alcoholic to be a member of AA. Our two co-founders couldn't be a member because they came to AA with the, quote, so-called, quote, dual problem, you know. You read Bill's story, you know, alcohol and sedatives, and Dr. Bob, alcohol and barbiturates. Now, sedatives, today they got different names. In them days, they used to roll them in like cigarette paper and potions and powders, and you'd take them, gulp it down with gin. That's what Bill liked to drink. Dr. Bob was a doctor. He was high class. You know, isn't it amazing the type of people that the co-founders of AA? Here was a drunken, busted stockbroker, and the other one was a drunken doctor, and he was a rear-end doctor at that. Now, isn't that something? Now, how about that for a bunch of drunks that are co-founders of AA? He was the fancy name for it is a proctologist. Yeah, yeah. Little did he realize that he'd worked on a lot of alcoholics, and he almost found the answer because he was working in an area where the alkies' really brains are, you know. You know, believe it or not, sure, in AA, yeah, you betcha. We're wired backwards, our kind. Our brains is in our rear end, and our rear end's in our head. That's the precise reason we can't sit in a meeting more than an hour. We wear our brains out, you know. And don't kid yourself, you can't have fun talking about tradition. Now, really, it takes a little looking into, and you know, like you kind of got to embellish it sometimes, but not too far off, because there's always somebody that's reading them things. You know, and they'll point it out to you. So, but you know, and as a result of it, nobody could be a member of A. So all the rules were thrown out. There's one sentence, tradition three. Well, then somebody's going to ask, well, this tradition is a rule that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Well, I want to ask you a question. Who determines in AA whether or not a newcomer qualifies? How alcoholic they are. I don't know about you. I've been in lots of AA groups all over this world, and I ain't ever seen an instrument they can stick in and up and down and through an alcoholic to tell you how alcoholic you are. This deal ain't like pregnancy, you know. No. When you got her, you got her. This ain't a 9-month deal. You can't abort it. That's what gives them churches such a hard time about alcoholics. You know, they got us. You know, we're here. Thank God we've got a solution. And as a result of it, so nobody, in other words, qualifiers, whether anybody wants to stop drinking. I don't know about you. I can't look at an alcoholic and say, you're going to stay sober the rest of your life. I don't even know if I'm going to stay sober the rest of my life. I hope I do one day at a time. Nobody. That is the individual's own business. Because you see, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have no definition of alcoholism. We've got descriptions of an alcoholic. And basically, we've got three descriptions of an alcoholic. One in Chapter 3 in the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. First one, more about alcoholism. There are many women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. The second one is in Chapter 4. We agnostic that if you decide you are unable to stop drinking, if when you honestly want to, you cannot stop drinking, yeah. Or if you have little control over the amount you take, then A is very gentle. It says then you're probably an alcoholic. I read that and I said I'm probably an alcoholic. that if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit drinking, or when drinking, you have a little control over the amount that you take. And then the third description is what? The first step. Twofold, mind and body. Any idiot knows that an alcoholic ain't spiritually correct in between drunks and drinking, unless they've got a spiritual program to live by. That was our problem before we got to AA. Our problem wasn't drinking and staying drunk. Our problem was inability to keep from drinking. The inability to keep from staying drunk. That's the reason we need the recovery program right now. You don't need it when you're drinking. Now is when we need it. And if we preserve it through the traditions to allow it for the now to live now, this is the reason we're all here right now. Because we do not know when the obsession to drink will return, but we know that it will. And if we're not on solid spiritual grounds at that time, then it may be too late. Nay, it just narrows it down one day at a time. This applies to groups. It applies to anything or anybody. And so as a result of it, many, in fact, you don't even have to say it aloud that I'm an alcoholic. Nobody can force you to do it, you know. Hey, you don't come to AA like you join the church or like you go to the Rotary or anything else, you know, or join the Toastmasters or the Country Club. I've never seen an alcoholic wake up and say, well, now I belong to the Rotary, I belong to the Lions Club, I belong to the church, I belong to the Country Club, I'm a big wheel on the community fund. I need something new to join. Today, let me look in the book. Well, I don't belong to this. I think I'll go down and join Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't quite get here that way. We certainly don't. And you say, well, you don't even have to say it aloud. And that's very unfortunate for us who arrived today with only a half-hearted desire to stay sober. You know why we're alive in AA today? Because somebody cared to keep the doors open for us. You know why we're sober today? Because we ain't drinking. Now, if it gets more complicated than that, I'm going to have to go get me another deal. And the reason I ain't drinking today is because I found a way to live with the pain of reality and live with the joys of reality and not feel so bad and get drunk and angry and crazy and not have to drink to celebrate how great I am. Now, if it gets more complicated than that, I'm going to get me another deal. I don't know about anybody else. And so as a result of it, you know, in AA, now, you know, who are we going to keep anybody out? Many a desperate drunk. And when I say alcoholic, as I said before, even though we may have other problems, you know. Now, I know there's a lot of them get up and say, you know, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm an alcoholic and a glue sniffer. I'm an alcoholic and a needle freak. You know. And all this and that. And that's okay. But after they stay in AA for a while, it's utterly amazing. 4 or 5 years down the line, hi, I'm an alcoholic. All the way down the line. Sooner or later, way down the line, you know, way down the line. And you don't have to pressure him about it, you know. And leave him alone, you know. Leave him alone. And, you know, one of the greatest things that's happened to Alcoholics Anonymous didn't happen as it happened yet. It really did. AA is really responsible for it. And that is, let's be realistic. You see, when treatment modalities came into existence, and the bottom line is money. And so as a result of it, they call it chemical abuse or chemical recovery, and in it, not only alcoholics, but straight addicts, coke addicts, you know, right down the line. And so they intermingle with the drunks, and then they'd go to open AA meetings, and then, or vice versa, bring in, and so when it was time for those who didn't have an alcohol problem, they had no place to go. And the only thing they knew was AA. They said, come on, go. And then they get into closed meetings, and they get to talking about shooting and snorting and all this, and somebody would raise 9 kinds of cane, you know. Did you ever drink? Well, if I would have drunk, I'd have been an alcoholic. And they said, no, that's not it. That's not it. So they came. And then what happened? They're kind of like, and so it got to be kind of tough for some of them. And so finally, they wanted to take our entire recovery program and use it, Narcotics Anonymous, and we said no. for reprint. So finally, through trial and error, and it's there in your central office, is their own recovery book called Narcotics Anonymous. And baby, it is a good one. It is real good. Because now that's for the straight addict, and I got kind of tickled. I've been to about 12 or 13, NA meetings, and I've been to their first really convention in Philadelphia. And I got kind of tickled. I'm sitting there and I'm listening, and the sponsor, one of them, says, "Now when you get up there, don't you talk about your drinking. You talk about your pilling and your shooting." I tell you, I said, "Well, if he drank, let him talk about it a little bit." No. And you know, but you see, they have a very serious, and it, the reason for it, you say, "Well, why?" Well, I'll tell you, it's real simple. It's very simple if you look at it realistically. You see, it is not illegal to go, if you're of legal age, to go in a whiskey store and buy whiskey. But it is illegal, or buy it on the street, as far as I go. But it's illegal to buy street drugs. And it's illegal to use forged prescriptions. And it's illegal to do those things, you know, even to make it. Why, heck, when I was a kid, I could make the finest cocaine you ever had in your life. All I needed was ether and acetone. And you can just shoot. I mean, you'd be real great. And I got kind of tickled. A bunch of them were sitting around one night. They looked at me and they called me, "Hey, old man." And I said, "Yeah, what is it?" And they, "What do you know about all this stuff?" I said, "I'm going to tell you something. When I was 10 and a half years of age, and I was living on that first Skid Row and drinking that wine, I said, we used to take a bottle and with a little whiskey leavings in it, and get some of that 37 cents half a gallon Muscatel and shoot that in there and about 30 aspirin. And then we'd take them cotton in deals out of them Benzedrine inhalers and squeeze them out with alcohol and everything else. And we'd smoke them. In them days, we called it grass. We didn't call it marijuana. And I said, we'd drink that stuff and smoke that grass. And I said, I could take a trip you couldn't even buy a ticket for, you know. And they looked at me, "Who you?" And I said, "There's nothing new in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'll tell you one of the greatest experiences that tells the whole story about our membership. Back in the old days in AA, the 23rd Street Clubhouse on 24th Street. Now that's typical of an AA name. You know, it's just like where we're meeting here now. This is typical. This used to be a mortuary deal, you know. And then great, here's where we revive dead bodies. And so anyway, back in those days, so the police brung this character in there, and they threw him in there and said, "Take care of him." Well, number one, he was okay. He had on a dress, and he had earrings in his ears, and he had makeup, lipstick, and rouge, and he had on a lady's hat with a net. He had an old boa wrapped around it, and he had on silk stockings and tennis shoes, and he was carrying a purse. And his hair was dyed blonde, and he was black. And Barry, who was on the desk, and he got to talking to Barry, and Barry says, "The police said he don't belong here. He believes with you people." Barry says, "Well, do you want to stop drinking?" And he says, "More than anything in the world." He said, "But I want to tell you that I'm different, and I'm black. And I shoot heroin, and I smoke marijuana, and drink that gin." Barry said, "Do you want to stop drinking?" Meanwhile, there's some rednecks sitting over there playing dominoes, and they looked over there, and them burly folks said, "Get that character out of here, Jack, get him out," or whatever it was, "get it out." And so they went up, picked him up, threw him out the door. Well, the police just brung him, and he had no place to go, and Barry picked up the phone and called Bill. "Bill, come down here. We have got a problem." So Bill comes down there and he opens the door and he's still looking at out there on the stoop, and he almost falls over backwards and turns around. "Barry, what's that?" He said, "That's the problem." He said, "Well, what is the problem?" And he told him how the police brought him, and said, "Do you want to stop drinking?" Meanwhile, there's some rednecks sitting over there playing dominoes. And they looked over there, and them burly folks said, "Get that character out of here, Jack, get him out," or whatever it was, "get it out." And so they went up, picked him up, and threw him out the door. Well, the police just brung him. And he had no place to go, and Barry picked up the phone, he called Bill. Bill, come down here, we have got a problem. So Bill comes down there, and he opens the door, and he's still looking at out there on the stoop, and he almost falls over backwards, and he turns around, Barry, what's that? He said, that's the problem. He said, well, what is the problem? And he told him how the police brought him, and then Bill said, well, did you talk to him? He said, did. Did he say he wanted to stop drinking? He said, yes. Are you satisfied that he may mean business? He says, yes. He says, that's all we have to know. So he went outside and he says, come with me. He picked him up and he took him over to that table where they're playing dominoes and sat him down. He said, boys, I want you to meet the newest member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He needs you and you need him. And that tells the whole story right there. Now, it's all in AA comes of age. It's all that. But our members won't read that. You see, there isn't anything in our traditions or any experience that hadn't happened before we all got here. That's the reason the traditions were written, you know. But we need to communicate about them. Well, okay, why don't we take a little break and get some coffee, and then if you want to ask some questions, and then we can go through the others pretty swift. Thank you very much. Well, welcome back, and we'll go on, and I'm still David, an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
And I haven't had a drink today since I've started, so... So, basically, this is what I'm here for, David Sobriety. So, tradition 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups as a whole. You know, and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who goes to a lot of meetings, our meetings, or travels away from, let's say, the locality or the local area or maybe the city or town in which they had gotten sober. Sometimes, and particularly in different parts of the country, have a tough time getting acclimated or feeling comfortable in the group. And, you know, early in my AA life, I'm glad I went out of town to an AA meeting to find out that the AA didn't start in that group and that the oldest member wasn't Bill Wilson in the group that I got sober, that AA was everywhere. And now a member who does any amount of traveling finds the AA spirit much the same everywhere. But apart from that inward kinship, there is a vast differences among groups. Now, sometimes, if you visit a group, you may find three members discussing the steps in someone's living room or the back seat of a car. And someone else, you may find as many as 200-300 listening to a talker in a church auditorium or to a facility such as this. In one part of the country, respectful silence greets the AA talker begins, hi everybody, my name is David A. and I'm an alcoholic. In another part of the country, everybody happily shouts back, hi David. And in many places, they may introduce themselves by their full name. They may just say I'm an alcoholic. They just give their first name, no initials. There are 1-hour meetings, hour-and-a-half meetings, 2-hour meetings, 3-hour meetings, 4-hour meetings, candlelight meetings, midnight meetings, 6 o'clock in the morning meetings, 12 o'clock in the morning meetings, women's meetings, men's meetings, barefoot meetings, and God almighty, and the incense-burning meetings, and candlelight meetings. And, you know, and in each neighborhood, in every town or city, in every part of the world reached by AA, the local group is free to work out its own customs. If it hadn't been, AA never would have spread where it did. Many years ago, the groups all over the United States, and they told Bill, and they said, now look, we will pay for services, but we don't want to be governed, and if we want to have an hour and a half meeting, that's our business. And if we want to have a 6-hour meeting, that's our business. And so Bill says, just as long as y'all stand sober, don't care if you meet all day. Doesn't make a bit of difference. There's no set format. In our part of the country, God, you can always tell when the hour's up, phone starts ringing. You know, and you go out to Southern California, which is, since the middle 50s, has had the largest contingent of numbers of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll find that the meetings out there basically are all the same. They're hour and a half meetings. Everyone who participates in a meeting, whether it be a closed meeting or whether it be an open meeting, are all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's all the same. They read the preamble, and then they read a portion of chapter 5, and then they'll have two or three, about three 10-minute talkers, and then they'll have a break, and then they'll have a 45-minute talker, and an hour and a half. And up in the East, it's a different matter altogether. They still have an hour and a half meetings. I remember when I was a delegate, and we had a Wednesday night free, and we went to one of the groups up there, and there's a bunch of us from Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Mississippi, and Louisiana, and Texas. We call ourselves the Bible Belt AAs, you know, Alabama. And for some reason or other, it's just kind of a nickname we hang on each other. And we all went to this open meeting, and this big meeting, and this monkey got up, and he gave his name, and we all screamed out, "Hi, Tony," and "Good God Almighty, you thought that we had ruined the Republic up there." Those people don't do that. And, you know, those people in the East, you know, they're not cold. It's just defect of character. And so as a result, you know, and they don't, and we find out a lot about those kind of things, you know. And AA never would have been able to spread all through the Deep South if it hadn't been autonomous and allowed certain things to grow. And so as a result of it, and now as always, though, however, freedom brings responsibility. Now, because each group is autonomous, it is up to each group to avoid any and all action that might harm AA. Now, there have been such actions, or this tradition would not be necessary. Because, now, blowing up the big size, the big ego may inspire one group to take over all the public information work for its area without consulting any of the other local groups. And this was prevalent in AA in the earlier days, because the first group, or the older groups, had the experience sobriety. And as a result of it, they felt that their experience entitled them or gave them the freedom to be of service to the community. You see, one of the biggest problems that we have, it's not really a problem, it's a challenge in AA today, is we have a lot of people that are capable of going out and telling their story, but they're not capable of telling what AA is not. And that's where the big challenge is. To the unknown public, you know, because when most of them are asked to go talk, let's say, at a Sunday school class, or else at a service club luncheon, or even in a big school meeting, or most members of AA, all they know is their story. And so, not utilizing AA's experience of what to say and when you're talking before a non-AA meeting, all this is available. And as a result, because I'll tell you the reason, you know, you take a drunk that tells his story over to the local Rotary Club. And he talks about, you know, how he is drunk and he fell out of a boxcar and the train ran over and cut his arm off. You know, and right away, and everybody feels sorry for him. The next thing you know, the civilians are taking up a collection to buy him a false arm. But he tells that same story at an AA meeting, and everybody screams and laughs and claps, you know. There's a one-armed drunk in our group, old Andy, and a little gal came in. Andy's been sober 20 years, and gal come in, and she saw that one arm there, and it's gone. And she says, "Oh, that must have been painful when you lost that arm." He looked at her and said, "Honey," he said, "tell you the truth." She said, "How'd you lose your arm?" He said, "Well," he said, "coming off my last drunk, I shook so hard it just fell off, you know." Now, we understand that, but you tell that out there in the non-world out there, and it's totally oblivious to them. But when we can talk about how an alcoholic can recover in AA, it's another matter altogether. And so, as a result of it, a lot of groups in those days decide they want to take over everybody's business in the group, and the lid blew off. And as a result of it, you know, it's only natural that we live in what we call the Madison Avenue era of advertising, and everything else, and a lot of members of AA that are coming to AA today feel that AA's 11th tradition is old-fashioned, that it was written back in them days. I got news for you. That's the reason we're here. Because those fool egos that ran wild back in those days are responsible for those traditions, and it darn near blew AA out of the tub. It certainly did with those early, horrible anonymity breaks. And considering the amount of members that we've got out in Alcoholics Anonymous today, there's a certain amount of discipline in AA that's here. And no humans have to exercise it. Because out of the multitude, millions of members that we've got, well, how many hundreds and hundreds of thousands we have in AA, and only a handful are out there violating their anonymity, that speaks very well for AA's silent discipline. And so as our individual and group develop, progress, we obey the AA traditions. Because we think they are right for us. We obey these principles because we think they're good principles. Even though sometimes we will resist. And you know, a lot of times when we violate a tradition, really it's ego saying, well, look how many people are going to get well because I'm going to tell them I'm a member of AA on rather than be in the newspaper or anything else. But what if you get drunk again? How many are you going to kill? Tell me if anybody in this room has got for absolutely sure that sober right this second can guarantee me or anybody else that 40 years from now they're still going to be sober. Well, this is what we're guaranteeing to people out yonder. This is exactly what we're doing when we do that. We don't know. We don't know. But at least we're telling them the truth when we say, I'm sober today. And I have been, et cetera, and et cetera, so long. You know, and it's human ego not to get out here and somebody say, well, how long have you been sober? And, well, I've been around the program 18 years. And then some wise monkey said, well, when'd you have your last drink? Oh, 4 days ago. Now, you get on television and start talking like that, what is the credibility to a drunk out there? Now, most drunks don't watch them kind of programs. A drunk is drinking at home, he ain't watching as the world turns. You know, he ain't reading the Watchtower. If he's watching television, it's when he comes to and got them test patterns on. You know, just like I didn't file to pay income tax for 18 years, and I'd ride around, my wife would be in the car, and I'm sober, and that fellow would come on for HR block, talk about your income tax, I'd switch to another channel. She'd punch it back. Yeah. And same way with the drunks drinking. You know, he didn't want anybody up here telling his story. And so now comes the final level of obedience. We obey these because we really want to for ourselves. It's not a question whether they're right or wrong. We conform because we genuinely want to conform. And such is our process of growth in unity and in function, and such is the evidence of God's grace and love among us. And you say, well, how now? Many people wonder how A can function under such seeming anarchy. Other societies have to have law and force and sanction, and the punishment administered by authorized people. Happily for us, we found that we need no human authority, whatever. In AA, we got two authorities, which are far more effective. One heals and one kills. There's God or Father who just simply says, here's my will, use it. And here's alcohol, and says, if you don't use God's will, I'll kill you. That's it. One heals and one kills. And so we don't, and sometimes it does kill. And so when all the chips are down, we conform to God's will or we perish. And at this level, the death sentence hangs on over the AA member, the AA group, and the AA as a whole. So there's authority enough, love enough, and punishment enough, all without any human being grabbing the handles of power, and such as AA's backdrop and backstop against dissolution and its final guarantee of survival under any and all conditions. Because I'll tell you why. For us, it's to do or to die. In this deal, as a recovering alcoholic, we either live the steps and face the consequences, or don't live the steps and face the consequences. As an AA group, we either live the tradition and face the consequences, or we don't live them and face the consequences. Doesn't make any difference. Either way around, we're going to have to face the consequences. Here comes a goodie, tradition 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, every newcomer learns the hard way, and some of us, every newcomer and some of us especially learn the hard way, rather, that this business of staying sober has to have top priority. If we fail at that, we'll never succeed at anything else. And so the fifth tradition just simply reminds each group that unless a group makes its primary purpose that of every alcoholic who comes to AA, the freedom to stay sober, then we are flirting with people's lives. Very often unthinking enthusiasm puts a group off the main track. One group, for example, offered expanded AA programs that include helping newcomers to find jobs. I've been in a lot of AA groups and look on their bulletin board and you can't find when they're meeting because they got signs up there, firewood for sale, babysitting, wanting cars washed, garage sale, bake sale, raffles, and this and that and that. And somebody's going to show a film on alcoholism and et cetera and et cetera. And you say, well, when do you meet? Oh, is that what you... Wait a minute, I have to ask somebody, you know? Now, Tradition 5 doesn't frown on the individual AA who tells another about the job, but a good job, but when the group turns itself into an employment agency, the newcomer may get confused about his primary purpose. Now, AA's function is to help an alcoholic get sober, and then that alcoholic can get himself on the payroll, or he can get a job, or he can quit it, whatever he wants to. That's really not AA's responsibility. It is not AA's responsibility, nor is it AA's concern. If you want to work, all we want to do is, what do you want to do about living sober? And then one can go on from there. Now, using discretion, a member may lend a few dollars needed for a meal or a room or even having a broke alcoholic to be a temporary guest in your home. You've never lived till you've had one of them temporary guests in your home and they stay for a year, you know. God, I remember I had one of them in there. And good God almighty, and one night there's a knock at the door, and I open it up, and, you know, police are police. I don't care if they got long hair and wearing boots and jeans, or they got a burr cut and smoking a pipe and wearing white socks and hush puppies. They're all the same. They got emotion. Out comes their hand, and out comes their picture and their badge, and they're all just, whoop, I believe they're born that way, you know. And there was two of them one night. And they said, are you so-and-so? I said, yeah. And one of them said, we got a paper here to search your house. I said, what for? We understand you're harboring a thief. I said, well, there was somebody here, but he gone. And I told him I'd met him down at the 24-hour club, and he didn't have a place to stay and all this and all that. And they said, well, we got to search. And I said, well, he did leave two boxes. And so they went in there, and he opened up the boxes, and my God, there were transistor radios in there, and rings, watching. And one looked at me, and he said, are you a fence? I said, what's that? He said, that somebody that's getting this stuff and reselling it, stolen merchandise. And I said, he said, well, you're going to have to come down to meet us. And so I get in the squad car with him, and I go down there, and I'm laughing all the way, and I'll tell you why. And we get down there, and these two detectives take this box, and they get somebody to sign, take the property room, and then they take me over to the night desk sergeant. And they tell him this and that, and then they leave. The desk sergeant looks up at me, and he says, sponsor. When are you going to learn? And, you know, and I told him what the deal was, you know. But a group as a whole is not a friendly finance company or a welfare agency or a divorce getting agency or a marriage and agency or a jail getting in or jail getting out an agency, you know, or a housing bureau. Even acting on our own as individual members of AA, an AA layman certainly shouldn't award himself an honorary or herself an honorary medical degree and hand out diagnosis and prescriptions and amateur analysis of other people's neurosis and sickness. Now, because this exact personal failing is so common in AA, the AA group should instill in every one of its members, and particularly the AA group, in all of its dealings, should be extra careful to emphasize that the group is not invading the medical field, the psychiatric field, the social worker field. Through the personal experiences of our members, we are only qualified to carry one message, how an alcoholic can recover in AA. And I'm going to share with you a personal experience. It's not the first time in AA that it's happened. It happens all the time. It's happening right now in an AA meeting somewhere in this world. There's a beautiful gal. And she was 23, 24 years of age when this happened. But from the time that she was 10 and a half, 11 years of age, she became a street urchin. And she developed into a mature, physical, and beautiful gal. But she started on alcohol and street drugs. And she had ended up in jail and for abusing and selling and you name it. And the time she was 18 years of age, she'd been in so much trouble. Her family totally disowned her. And she was living here and there in one of them live-ins, live-out deals. Staying strung out and drunk all the time. And one night she had one of them sports cars that'll do 120 standing still with one of them fiberglass bodies. And she was strung out and she was out in the country just way out up in a tree and somewhere. And she was driving about 120 miles an hour. She missed a curve and hit a huge oak tree head on. And naturally, the front of the car collapsed, threw her through the windshield. When she came through, the top of her skull hit the trunk of the tree and just crushed it. Through some miracle, she did not die. And she spent many, many weeks and many, many months in intensive care and later on, but with a lot of traumatic injuries to the brain and through some very skillful surgery and through God's grace, she didn't die physically. But all for practical purposes, many, many thought she was just a vegetable. And when she did, she had her recall mechanism was practically gone and she had halting speech and she couldn't think and her memory, it was a mess. And well, her family said they disowned her. They didn't know how to do so. They had to get a court committed and they put her in the insane asylum and committed her to be there for the totally insane for the rest of her life. And when she was admitted to the insane asylum, and a lot of times we ridicule civilians. We ridicule psychiatrists. We ridicule physicians and we blame them for our dilemma. They got me hooked. They did this to me. It's an utterly amazing thing. I ain't ever heard one say I didn't enjoy it. That's the reason why I went back to get hooked. Okay. So, there was a Cuban refugee who was a psychiatrist. Somewhere along the line, he had had a lot of experience working with alcoholics someplace, somewhere. And after reading her case history, he suspicioned that she was an alcoholic. And that if she was, there was a place where she could get well, or better. And that was over at the alcoholic recovery unit in the state hospital. Right there on the ground. And so as she began to progress, his suspicion now confirmed into belief. And he knew that if she was ever going to get any better, that his medical science and art could not give it to her. Psychiatry couldn't give it to her. Shock treatments and that kind of therapy couldn't do it to her. But there was one place that had the medicine for her malady. And that was them AAs, and the medicine was love. Caring and sharing and loving. That's where the power of our society lies, folks. One drunk talking to another. We care about each other and share about each other because we're a common bond of experience. Because you can't give away something you don't possess. And so when she got a little bit better, they moved over to the alcohol recovery room, and God, she just started blooming just like a rose. Just blooming. And when the gals from the outside groups would come in and bring the program, and they'd talk with her, and they brought her pantyhose, and they brought her makeup, and they brought her a hair dryer, and they taught her how to put makeup on again. She couldn't even recall how to do that, and fixed her hair, and God, and everything, and clothes. And she kept saying, if I ever get out of here, can I be a member of AA? And they said, well, if you want to. And finally, she was allowed to go out one weekend, and they took her to AA meetings everywhere, and God, she enjoyed herself so much. And finally, the day came that, you know, that they said she was well enough if she wanted to go out in the outside world, as long as she had a sponsor, and as long as she had a place to live. Well, they brought her into one of the gals' house for about 3 weeks, and then they found a little job for her to do there in the apartment to make a few dollars, and then they found a little garage apartment for her, and she started going to the AA groups, and God, she just, everybody loved her, and she loved AA, and this was her family, and she was just growing and blooming, and then the night came when she sat in one of them closed AA discussion meetings to where everybody in there is an expert. And the topic for discussion that night was, are you really sober if you're also taking medication? Well, it got around to her, and because of her traumatic brain surgery, for the rest of her life, she was on Dilantin and a mild dose of phenobarbital, which is the standard medical prescription and treatment for seizures of that nature and convulsions. And it got around to her, and she got to talking about how she's on Dilantin and phenobarbital, and right there and then, three members sitting in that group jumped her up and says, you're not sober, you're taking dope. And you gotta have, throw it away, and you've gotta have a new sobriety date. And not knowing any better and thinking that she'd be kicked out of AA and she had no family, and she went into the secretary's office and asked for her sobriety card, scratched out her original sobriety date, put out a new one, went home and threw all of her prescribed medication, which she was not abusing, down the toilet and flushed them down. And 3.5 weeks later, she had a seizure and a convulsion the kind that Gatorade and honey won't stop, salt water sipping won't stop, and she died. Her sponsor called me, and she says, I called her parents, and they said, what are we going to do? And they said, we have no daughter. She called me, and I was her male sponsor, and I said, we'll have a funeral. I don't know about up here, but we have a group of us that we have a few lots scattered around for our less fortunate brothers and sisters. Even some of them went back to drink. Then she said, who are we going to have pallbearers? I said, I know three. And I called up them three members of AA and asked them if they'd be pallbearers. And coming back from the services, they rode with me, and the one that had been sober 5 years, he said to me, where do we go wrong? And I said, the AA group and the AA members and all of our dealings should be extra careful to emphasize that we are not invading the medical field. Only through the personal experiences of our members are we qualified to carry one message. How an alcoholic can recover in AA. And I said, gentlemen, we've got a lot of doctors in AA, but we haven't got one physician. We'll let the physician do the healing. We ain't gonna kill folks. Now that's a common practice in AA, believe it or not. That's not isolated. It happens all the time. That's what I meant a while ago, that, you know, we're great about talking about saving lives. We don't ever talk about the ones we kill. You know? We certainly did. Now if we share our own personal experiences, that's one of the reasons why, if I have the privilege to call on a wet drunk on a 12-step call, and I still go on them. I don't tell them to drink. I don't tell them to not drink. I don't tell them to go to AA. I don't tell them not to go. I just tell them my story. Period. That's all I'm qualified to tell them. Nothing else. That's the only experience that I can share with them. Because you see, a wet drinking drunk, when you tell him, you say, look, can't you see what's happening to you? If he could see what's happening to him, he'd see. Can't you hear what they're saying about you? If you could hear it here. It's that stuff you're drinking, it's killing you. Let me have it, and you grab it and take it away from him, and that drinking drunk will give you the most logical answer you'll ever hear in your life. And he says, no, it's not killing me, but take it away from me, it'll kill me. I have to have it to live, I have to have it to sleep, I have to have it to eat, you may not have ever heard that in AA, or have you? Well, you better listen to it sometime, I'll tell you. We're talking about old-timey AA, and we're talking about the kind of stuff that's been responsible for lives living sober. Whether we like it or not. Whether we like it. I didn't like to hear those things when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've seen some very, very sad things happen in AA, along with the joyous things in AA. And, you know, and it's so easy. It's just like you walk into a drinking bar right now with a bunch of drunks in there, and you walk up to them, and you say, how you doing? Fine. Fine. We don't like to talk about those challenges. We don't like to talk about until they override us. And so, you know, as a result of it, when the temptation in AA as far as education, the public and everything else is stronger at the time this tradition was written. Because public ignorance about alcoholism as an illness was more widespread than it is now. And since then, other agencies have sprung up to assume the job of educating the general public on alcoholism. Now, education and educating the public on alcoholism is not AA's purpose. No. Only what AA can and will do for an alcoholic if that alcoholic is willing to let it happen to him. Now, because these agencies, such as the National Council on Alcoholism, all the state agencies on alcoholism, mental health and retardation, and alcohol and drug abuse, and etc., we can go on right down the line, are also trying to help the active alcoholic. They are our friends. And so Tradition 6 now establishes the boundaries of this relationship and allow us to work our side of the street and them to work our side of the street, and ain't nobody getting run over jaywalking in the middle. And then we can walk and each of us do what we've got to do. The reason that the National Council on Alcoholism was started, it was started by the thinking of Bill Wilson and several others to do the things that AA had no business doing. Period. And so Tradition 6, an AA group ought never endorse financial NDA named any related facility or outside enterprise unless problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Now, the related facility may be a group, outside group combating alcoholism or an enterprise that AA's want to start. And it was the latter that most confronted our young fellowship, and you know what, today it still confronts our fellowship. Particularly with all the grant money, with all the monies that are available today. Not so bad now, but back when the Hughes-Javits bill come in, AA's all over the world were leaving AA going into the drunk business. And you'd go into the group and say, I ain't seen you in a long time. Oh, David, I'm a 7. I said, what's a 7? Well, I work for the government. That's the pay scale. Oh. And I said, what are you doing? He said, David, all my life, all I've ever wanted to be was an alcoholism counselor. I said, well, it took you 20 years to admit that you're an alcoholic. And how long are you sober now? 8 months? And all your life, that's all you've ever wanted to be is an alcoholism counselor, you know. Well, thank God. Agencies found out that just because drunks made a few 12-step calls and sponsored a few, that that was not the qualification to be an alcoholism counselor. And they started an education process and that to be accredited, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Some have made it. Now, it emptied out and a lot of them went out. Some of them, you know, got drunk and they ain't ever come back. And some of them got drunk, came back, and some are still sober. And in AA's early days, outside agencies were pretty scarce. And so some AA members thought that the AA should cover the whole alcoholism field. Well, our old Alcoholic Foundation, which was incorporated, it was incorporated to do everything in the field of alcoholism. Everything in this God's world. It could heal drunks, it could unheal them, it could throw them out of AA, it could do everything in the world. But that was changed. And years ago, some super promoters in AA built an all-purpose center, including a section for drying out treatment, you know. But what happened? Lawsuits got involved, and it got into the newspapers, and a lot of problems were going on. And they'd have meetings, and groups got involved in it, you know. And one group in particular decided it was renting a building, and it had vacancies down to the next 3 or 4 stores. And they had a meeting one night to see about taking it over, and then they were going to have a rehabilitation house in there for the drunks, and then they were going to make furniture, and they're going to sell flowers on the corner like the flower folks do, and make money for the deal. And then they got to argue about how you're going to sober them up. Are you going to use phenobarbital and suppositories, or what are you going to do with them, you know? Are you going to bring them off, let them walk and shake out a drunk, or bring them off on bay rum and wine? And they got to arguing, and it got kind of bad, and this actually happened. And the door opened up, and a little drunk stuck in, and one of them said, who are you? He said, I'm an alcoholic, and I want to get sober. Is this where you're? He said, well, go over there and get you some coffee. We got an important business meeting going on, and when we get through with our business meeting, then we'll tend to you. And that's what we mean by diverting away from the primary purpose of the group. And as a result of, now that ambitious center, they never got off the ground. Some individual members have found some very successful, nowadays, you know, my God, they got every kind of a house you want. They got a three-quarter house, halfway house, quarter house, 7 3/8 house, 2-millimeter house. They got them all the way down to just house, you know. And they are run by AAs and patronized by other members or prospective members, but money and property are involved. And so, therefore, it's been proven wise by our own experience to keep the operation of the facility completely separate from that of the AA group. A names like the 12-step, 4-step, first step out of the name. Now, towards outside agencies dealing with alcoholism, the AA policy is very simple, cooperation but not affiliation. And a group cooperates, for example, if it wants to, by the vote of its members. Nothing is binding in AA. You can't force a group to do anything. A group don't even have to turn its money in. It can do with it whatever it wants to. It has to live with only the consciousness of its own being honest. And, oh, alcohol loves actively dishonest drunks that are sober. It just sits there, licks its chops. Yeah, I'm going to get me another one tonight. You know, and it does. And as a result of it, cooperation but not affiliation. Now, a group cooperates by welcoming referrals from treatment facilities or from modality. The thing that I don't understand about treatment facilities, I wish somebody, if you got them in this area, go back and tell them. When they recently said, now you go to 90 meetings, 90 days, 60 meetings, but why don't they say, you not only go to meetings, but stay in AA. Stay in AA. It's the only hope you got out there. Stay in AA. And so, we welcome them from court committed, you know, and from institutions. A group can vote on whether it wants them in there or not, believe it or not. Yeah. Or if they want them to participate, come to an open meeting, sit there, sure can. But in one area, money for a rehabilitation house was solicited at AA meeting, implying affiliation. In another area of the country, AA was listed among beneficiaries of United Fund Drive. And you say, well, somebody goofed. Well, they sure did. Now, AA members employed by outside agencies, we used to call them two-hatted, wear two hats, but tradition six cautions against any such member against wearing both hats at once. It's impossible for a drunk to wear two hats at the same time because we ain't got but one head. Now, on the job, he or she may be an alcoholism counselor, but he or she is not an AA counselor. There's no such thing as an AA counselor, AA doctor, AA lawyer, AA housewife, AA bum, AA banker. We ain't got but one kind of AA. That's an AA member. It doesn't say whether what sex or what color or what preference or whatever it is. And it sure helps if you're sober. That's all. We ain't got one kind, and that's an AA member. Now, at meetings, you know, at meetings, on the job, as I said, at meetings, he or she is just an AA, not an alcoholism expert. So today, and we understand the paradox that the more AA sticks to its primary purpose, the greater will be its helpful influence everywhere. And, you know, we're all perfectionists, and after failing at perfection, we'd gone to the other extreme. And we'd settle for the bottle and the blackout. And then Providence through Alcoholics Anonymous had brought us within reach of our highest expectations. So it became good reason with this kind of thinking, why shouldn't we share our way of life with everyone? And it makes sense, doesn't it? So in the early days, they tried hospitals. They all folded because you cannot put an AA group into business. Too many busybodies mess up the formula. Then AA groups in AA it's almost impossible to have an AA group in business because if you got 30 members, you got 30 dictators. Yeah. Then the AA groups had to try education, and when they began to publicly drumbeat the merits of this or that brand, people would start getting confused. And they said, well, did AA fix drunks, or was it an educational project? Was it spiritual? Was it medical? Was it a reform movement? So in utter confusion and disgust, AA found itself getting married to all kinds of enterprises, some good, some not so good. Then some AA groups started hounding AA legislatures for legal reforms in this business, committing drunks to prison and asylum. And in those days, it made good reading, but little else. Then AA became mired into politics. And even AA, and inside AA, we, as I said before, found it imperative to take the name off of clubs and 12-step houses. And so the experience, as a result of our experiences, implanted a deep-rooted conviction that in no circumstances could AA endorse any related enterprise, no matter how good. Because we of AA cannot be all things for all people, nor should we try. And then, of course, many of you read AA Becomes of Age about the member who thought about taking a public relations job at one of the large distilling companies to educate the public why alcoholics should not consume alcohol. Everybody knows why an alcoholic should not consume alcohol except the alcoholic. Everybody knows it. But that liquor association wanted that member to use his full name and all of his advertising, and he was to be described as its director of publicity and as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there couldn't be the slightest objection if such an association hired an AA member solely because of his public relations ability and his knowledge of alcoholism, but that was not the whole story. For in this case, he not only was an AA member to break his anonymity at the public level, he was to link the AA name to that particular educational project and also to that distiller in the minds of millions. Now, I'm going to tell you the kind of alcoholic I am. If I was drinking and that monkey got on there with his full face and he says, I'm a member of AA and I'm working for this buzzard liquor company, I'll tell you what I'd say, and he's sober. My mind says, hey, baby, David, baby, you can drink that buzzard liquor and you ain't going to be no alcoholic. Maybe I'm the only alcoholic in this room who thinks that way. I'm the kind that you tell me don't walk on the grass, I walk on the grass. You tell me it's wet paint, don't touch, I touch it. Here's the one I love. Don't take food or drink out of the dining room. Oh, I love it. It's just like these signs in here. No smoke. But before the meeting, they ought to reverse them. You know what I mean? Yeah. No smoking. Really. And that is an absolute, it's a demand for an alcoholic to violate it. You put absolutely no smoking in there, and this place would be full of smoke. But if you put, please refrain from smoking, you know, no smoking, we're pretty good about it now. And so, as a result of it, that particular member, he came to the censors in question, realized that AA saved his life. And it had to come first. And he certainly didn't want to be the guy to land AA in big time trouble, and this we certainly did. We were talking about this a while ago before we got started again, sir. Concerning endorsements, our friend said it all. We have never before that we could lend the AA name to any cause other than our own. Tradition 7. Every AA group ought to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Now, we have to be practical. A group can hardly hold its regular meetings on a street corner in an empty basket when not pay the rent or fill a coffee pot. And as soon as we become active in AA group, we learn how many other expenses are involved in making meetings reasonably effective. Then our horizons broaden. What about that inner group? Our central office, many of us call to ask for help. Phone companies do not give free service. God, they're so thankful we're sober and not calling South Pole and asking for a penguin bootlegger or calling Russia or somewhere. You know? And beyond our own local locality, we learn about the AA General Service Office and the work it does for groups worldwide. AA activity ought to be self-supporting at all levels. And in every case, if it isn't, the responsibility comes right back to us. Our individual members. Because we are AA. We own Alcoholics Anonymous. It is ours. And it doesn't belong to anybody else. And we express the results of Alcoholics Anonymous, the recovery program, and our unity and our services to the world in which we all live. And so, sometimes when we're new, our contributions rattle. You know? You don't see this much in AA groups anymore. They hardly pass a collection of coffee can because it is kind of embarrassing, you know. You drop in and you put a quarter in and go plunk, you know. And everybody, it's usually the tightest one in the group anyway. And they rustle rather than rattle. And the fancy groups, you know, they either borrowed them or bought them from churches, you know, and then plates with the felt in the middle. That's high class. But if you ever watch one of them, they got a teller at each end of the row to be sure that the collection gets to the back. And one of the funniest things, It's funny. It really is funny. In a large group here, and I happen to be in the meeting in New York. And it's a big meeting. You must have had about 350 in there, and they have the secretary's break. And that's when they take up the collection, because they're an hour and a half meeting. And right as they got through the collection, here come four fellas with stockings on their hat, and they grabbed the take, and out they went to the back door. They robbed the group, you know, right there. Yeah, you know, and in the old days, you used to say, if you got one, put one in. If you need one, take one. They quit doing that when more money disappeared than got put in, you know. And as a result of it, you know, but the first members weren't as fixed. They were busted, and to them, they felt that they needed some outside help more than the modest gifts were coming in. And their plans required some big shot ideas of philanthropy. But as one of the greatest friends that Alcoholics Anonymous ever had, and he gave us the greatest piece of experience that AA could possibly ever be given to us for nothing, was John D. Rockefeller Jr., an early AA friend, who said, "I'm afraid money will spoil this thing, and I'm not going to be the one that's going to spoil it." And a few AAs had already reached the same conclusion. Gradually, minority became the majority, and experience showed that our own members ourselves, when we are informed what it is needed for, we could provide enough to finance AA's proper aim. So it's a simplest application. Tradition 7 is easily understood when we hear about an AA group being started with funds from a federal grant. But then we come to the borderline cases. Groups that put on a raffle for the benefit of their central office and invite the public. It's nothing wrong if you don't put on a raffle as long as our members participate. But when you go out on the street and sell them to everybody and their brother to buy tickets, or have a weekly bingo party and invite the public to participate, or have a dance and go out and sell tickets and invite everybody to come in, you know, now these projects would be routine for other societies, but for us, such actions just simply mean that we got our hand out again asking non-members for money. You know, there was a group in one part of the country that they went out and they formed a group, and they had about five members. And the group didn't grow. It just stayed five members. And then they got one and they got six, but it didn't grow. But they were real, you know, they went out and like any good thinking drunk does, they didn't go buy 10 chairs, they bought 50. And they're sitting there in this room with 50 chairs and nobody, and they went out and bought 50 big books to sell. They just knew that everything's going to be fine. But they forgot one thing. You know, you can ask God something, and as long as you sit there, it ain't going to happen. You know? He said, now get up and do it. And so they decided, well, they need to get people in here, so they decided to play bingo on Saturday night. And it would start at 9:30, and the meeting was 8 to 9. Well, word got out, and they started coming out there. And that little old meeting, the next thing you know, they're coming in at 8:30 to get a bingo seat. And finally, they moved the bingo back to 7 o'clock. But the bingo games got big, and they were giving away cash prize, and the group started, not the group, the bingo game. They knocked out a wall, and they had a bunch of people in there, and they invited their neighbors and grandma and everybody to show up. And God, they were doing real good. It got big, and heck, man, I'll tell you, there was something else. And they decided, well, this bingo's so good, why don't we have another bingo night? Let's have it on Tuesday night. Somebody said, what about the meeting? I said, what the heck with the meeting? Them bingos is paying the rent. Then they moved to another place to where they could accommodate about 500 people. And then they had to have somebody to take care of it, so they built a little room and got a one-legged drunk in there. clean up the place, put the bingo cards out, and get the balls ready, and get the proper change and everything. And so he was cleaning up the place one day, and in comes a big limousine, and three well-dressed men walked in there and said, are you the manager here? He said, yeah. He said, got a nice place here. He said, can I help you, gentlemen? He said, yeah, do you have any insurance? He said, what kind of insurance? Well, you know, fire insurance, explosive insurance, you know. He said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, you need that kind of stuff. And then one lady looked at him, and he said, this is AA. We are a spiritual entity, and God will protect us. And he says, is that your answer? Yeah. Well, about 3 weeks, the roof blew off. Well, you know, drunks, we ain't stupid. Sensitive, but not stupid. And one's good, two's better, so they went out and got a bigger place, and the bingo games got bigger. Oh, they had two token AA meetings a week, and then the next thing you know, they had three more visitors. And so, the question was the same, do you have insurance? And you know, those folks are, they're different. They don't make 12-step calls on people like we do, you know. And they said, you know, it'd be a shame if this place should, calamity happen and there are women and children in here, you know. The drunk said, I said, get out, God will provide. So they left, said, yeah, sure, yeah, and then the roof and the back wall blew off. So the drunks, one's good, two's better, three's terrific. They went out and they had a lot of money. So they bought a piece of property, and they built a concrete slab floor for this building with reinforced steel. You could land one of them 747 airplanes on that thing. And they got a Butler steel building and dynamite proof and dropped the ceiling. And bingo games got up as high as 1,200 people. Got huge amounts of cash, money, and they were coming in. They had three more visitors, and he gave them the same answer. Well, the next time that thing blew, it blew concrete slab, reinforced steel floor, Delta building, bingo balls and cards all the way into New Mexico. Well, I got a phone call from our general service office and one of the secretaries, and they had the news media up there, not only television, but radio from every one of the networks wanting to know what in the devil is going on. This was broadcast already on the morning show, on the noon show, at the 6 o'clock news in the morning, and they want to know is what's all this gambling and dynamiting. Well, you see what happened. Anytime you use dynamite or explosive, you got the Treasury boys on you, my friend. You betcha that's the Secret Service, and they're real nosy about things like that. And they want to know what in it. And when they call me, I says, well, I don't know why you call me. This is the third time. Well, they saw the errors of their way. And they went and started another group and started working with drunks. And the group just growing. And guess what? They had a business meeting last summer and they decided to start the bingo again. So that's what we talk about. You ain't got sanity and sobriety forever. Yeah. And, you know, often, of course, we don't have to ask. AA is now high on the worthy list of our members. Oh, yes. AA politely turns down many unsolicited give requests. Particularly, we do not take from non-alcoholics. Period. Our conference team voted a limit of $500 that you give a year to our general service office. Why are you lying? $500 a year, and you will, and it has to be given in the year in which you die, and it can't be perpetuated. Now, you can give $100,000 to AA anytime you want to. Just get you $100,000 $1 bills and go to a lot of meets. You know? Money may pose another problem if a group treasury grows too fat beyond a sensible reserve. Well, there's a simple solution that strengthens our unity and advances our purpose. Give the excess to AA activities and services. So when our trustees declared the principle that AA must always stay poor, for the principle of corporate poverty was firmly and finally embedded in AA's tradition. Now, when newspapers and the other media, news media, got hold of those facts, there was an immediate and profound reaction. To people who are familiar with endless drives for charitable funds, AA presented a strange and refreshing thing. Approving editorials both abroad and in this country generated the confidence and a new wave of confidence and respect in the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they pointed out that the irresponsible had become responsible by making financial independence part of its tradition. Self-supporting alcoholics, who ever heard of it? That's one of the greatest things that's happened to us, is the fact in what Rockefeller told us. And that in plain this corporate poverty. You know, it takes very little money to stay sober. We don't need a lot of money. Because when we get into money, then we get to arguing about what to do with it. And every drunk is a financial expert. And you know what an expert is, don't you? That's a drip under pressure. An expert about everything. They get to arguing and fighting over it. Best thing to do is empty her out and give her away. Do whatever you want to with it, whatever the group wants to vote. But always remember this. Be willing to face the consequences. That's all. So that's not punitive in nature, is it? Tradition 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Well, spiritual as it is, AA remains very much of this world. The 8th tradition, like the 7th, focuses on the vulgar five-letter word that's not mentioned in any of the traditions called money. How many have had to explain to some cynical prospect, no, I'm not a social worker, I do not get paid for talking with you or sitting with you while you check out a drunk. We do this because it's part of our work, part of our staying sober. However, this doesn't mean, of course, that the idea of turning professional has never entered any AA's mind. Now, in the lean years, our co-founder, Bill Wilson, he thought that he could, because of his experience, he would become a lay therapist to earn money in helping alcoholics. And so he went to the drunks and said, Colonel Towns wants me to work there as a deal. And they looked at Bill and said, well, you're the head horse. And here you are, you're telling us what not to do, and you're going to turn around and do it. And so Bill got a nudge from the group conscience at that time that he could never hang out a sign reading Bill Wilson, AA Faith Healer, at $10 an hour. And so it became clear to the early members of AA that no member of AA should ever ask her except paying for carrying a message to somebody else. That's the AA message. About our own personal experience, person to person, face to face. You say, well, what about those who are members of AA, who work in treatment facilities, or who work for our agencies? They are working there as a job. Now, they're there because they're sober. But if they're just sitting there telling their story to them folks, then they ain't doing the job. That's a business. See, the difference between treatment and AA is two. AA is recovery, and treatment is treatment. Now, we do treat alcoholics in AA. You know how we treat them? Real good. But you see, the bottom line in AA is not money. No treatment facility can operate without paying its bills. It's got to get money someplace, somewhere. And they've got a unlimited market out in that world because they're uncovering them more every day. And there's some that are not satisfied. This has nothing to do with AA, but AAs get involved in them and drag it into meetings and drag them into groups and ask them to come and share and all this and all that. And some treatment facilities can't cut the mustard just treating drunks and other addicted people. They're treating stop smoking, weight reduction, and a lot of other things, you know. And some AA members say, well, it's all in the same, you know. And I was sitting in a treatment facility not long ago, and one of them, he said, now, you go to AA and don't let them give you any guff. Now, David here, alcohol was a chemical of his choice, and you go, Valium was a chemical of your choice, although you, and I said, wait a minute. I never went to the whiskey store and said, sell me a half a gallon of chemical. You can call it whatever name you want to call it. I'll call it what name I call it, and you ain't no more authority than I am about it. But let's just set the deal straight. That's all. Now, why don't you tell this young man that he's welcome to come to AA? And I'm not going to ask him whether he's an alcoholic or whether he's an addict or whether he's a gorilla. Let him come on. And then I'm going to ask him the question, when you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to any length again, then you're ready to take certain steps. And it's in the deal, you for yourself will have to make up the mind whether you belong or not, and not what somebody else tells you what you need to do. And the sooner you learn that simple principle of freedom, you got a chance to live in this world. And I said, you know, I got to wondering one day, you know, if I die and if I go to heaven. And I get up there and the man said, and I said, now, where is the meeting? I want to be secretary to AA group up here. And I got to wondering if I got up there and said, David, you're not even an alcoholic. And then I got to thinking about, you know what? Nobody ever questioned whether I was an alcoholic or not. They just took my word for it. They didn't test me. They didn't take my blood or they didn't smell me or nothing else. They just took my word for it. And you know what? I got to listen to them people. And they just like me. They did the same thing as everything else. And so, when the questions arose about our membership and the word of hope sending thousands of alcoholics in search of A, the first intergroup or central offices were usually manned by A volunteers. Now, today, such offices are so busy that full-time employers are needed as well, and naturally, AAs would be better suited for such jobs than non-members. But then, are these AAs being paid for doing 12-step work? No, they're being paid there to answer the phone, to inform people where AA is, and if it's a real good, real functioning central office, it will also have, and they say, well, is it for an alcoholic? No, I'm living with one, and he's driving me crazy. And so whoever's on the phone says, just a minute, here is the number for Al-Anon. We suggest that Al-Anon have you. Or if they say, no, it's not an alcoholic, but I got a son that's an addict. Just a minute, here's number for Narcotics Anonymous. Or here's the number for a brute. That is a community service. That is the greatest attraction that our kind of people are here to help people that God that you'll ever know of in your life. Those people, they turn to us as a court of last resort. And I always carry a list of those things to make it available to people. And I make it my responsibility because I run into things like this all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to people all to know, and they want to know where is a place that they can go. And if you don't have any money or third party pay, is there some place they can go? I got a list of that here. And this is what the central office is for, to tell a drunk where a meeting is. Would you like to have some literature? Some church organization calls up. We'd like to have somebody come and talk to our Alcoholism Awareness Week. Can you send somebody? The intergroup has got the number. That's the function of those things. And if they're on the phone 12-stepping a drunk and telling them about their story all the time, then they're not working at a job. Then that's a paid 12-stepper. This is what we're talking about. However, when the meeting is over with, I mean when their business day is over with, you know, when their business day is over with, when they go to the group, they're going for themselves, and they're getting paid for their sobriety. I mean, their sobriety is being paid right there. And that's one of the ways we stay sober. They used to call it paying a little premium on your insurance policy. And that's the way it used to be. And that's the way it is. And so now, as a result of it, you know, today our general service office is huge. And these general service offices, and we have over 90-some-odd employees. Members are actually paid for the business professional skills, working on conference-approved literature, and et cetera, and et cetera. Now, we do have volunteers, and the volunteers a lot of times, and thank God they're translators. It's very, very difficult to translate the message from one language to another without getting it garbled. For instance, in the German dictionary, there are four different definitions of spiritual. And finding the one word that would fit all of them folks over there that are German-speaking members of AA was quite a chore, and they finally got a good translation of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that came out here in the last 5 or 6 months. And it is an excellent, excellent, excellent book. But finding it is tough because why? We need to have people who translate who know street language. It's very difficult. Now, you get someone who has a college degree and a doctorate in, let's say, Italian, and you've got a drunk laying out there in the canal out there in Venice, and he's just retching his guts out, and he writes and he talks. Now, I never use this word except only when I do tradition, period. It isn't that I'm against it, but I just don't use it. But there's no word like it. You can't substitute for it, and that's the word puke. There is no word like puke. Throwing up ain't puking. Sick at the stomach ain't puking. And he's laying out there and he writes the letters. Oh, he's puking in the canal out there. And some bird brain writes back in Italian, well, I did the same thing. Well, I think I understand. I accumulated a lot of gas and come through my ears and my nose. And that drunk over there said, what have I got a hold of? But if you get someone who can speak street Italian and he writes down there and talks about him puking in the gutter, aha, he's one, two. You see, that is where the power of our society lies. And so, you know, and as a result of it, and our literature, now please take our literature. Please take our literature. You know, This is one of the most popular pieces of literature that we got in the area. Can't keep it in stock. What happened to Joe and the other ones, what happened to Alan? We can't keep them. We don't know where, and it's comic style, and we believe that the reason it's so popular, because in comic style, it appeals to the basic intelligence of most drunks. And so when this thing, the thing came out, Lewis R., who is still alive in from Philadelphia, he was a delegate to the General First Congress, first black delegate, and they were getting ready to do this, and Bill asked Lewis, said, Lewis, where are all the blacks in AA? And we're all drunk. He said, well, I guess they're not reading, they're not in AA, they're in the penitentiary. And so he said, well, we're getting ready to put this out. What do you think about a black, have a black face? But Lewis said, fine, as long as it's not mine. Well, this is a four-color press. That goes to artist and illustrator and everything else. So I went to the artist and illustrator, and you always get the cover before you get the inside of it. And it came back, and the black standing there, my God, it was black, black. And the black looked at it and says, my God, it'll offend the lighter-skinned one or this or that. Lighten it up. So it goes back to the artist and illustrator, and it came back, and guess what? It was too light. It looked like a Puerto Rican. And, well, if any of y'all ever live in some parts of the country, the Chicanos and Puerto Ricans and the blacks, well, they just ain't on the best social behavior. So they sent it back and said, darken it. So it went back, and it came out this color, chocolate. Not too light, not too dark. Universal. And that is the reason that our literature is the greatest asset that we have. Because it's not one drunk's opinion. It is a collection of experience of universal living in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the reason you do not see the name of an author on any of our books or pamphlets. The only one that you'll see the name of the author on is only one booklet. And I bet you never know. It's on the front cover of the 12 concepts. Down at the bottom it says Bill W. It's the only one. It's the only one. Now, you may somebody say, well, what's going on? Didn't Dr. Bob say, let's keep it simple, that the precise reason our conference approved literature expresses the simplicity of our fellowship. Unfortunately, too many of our AA literature racks are cluttered up with non-AA literature. And this is what Dr. Bob meant when he said, let's keep it simple and don't louse it up with Freudian concepts that appeal to the scientific mind. Tradition 9A, such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those certain. You've got a service board and committee that operates right here in this facility. Got an office in there. It's organized. You bet. And it serves the AA committee for their literature needs. And for the things that it is. And each one can be autonomous. But so let the words just keep it simple where the last Bill Wilson heard from his fellow co-founder of Dr. A. shortly before Dr. Bob's death in 1950. And aware of the word it means our recovery program, Bill later wrote, we need to distinguish sharply between spiritual simplicity and functional simplicity. And when we get into actions by groups or areas or A as a whole, we find that we must to some extent organize to carry the message or else face confusion. Confusion is not simplicity. When Tradition 9 speaks of AA as such, it goes to the heart of AA's experience, to the spiritual simplicity of one alcoholic saying to another, perhaps help, and another alcoholic answering, I know how you feel. We're here to help you. Now, such a relationship could not be organized, or could it? No, it's highly personal. It's touch and feel. A non-member who is not familiar with AA, the way we operate, and who is familiar with modern business procedures might examine the AA practice of sponsorship and see it as a haphazard operation. That's the reason why it works, because it's haphazard. Now in the nowadays, and drunks, you know, nowadays in the computer age, well, someone, why don't you computerize it? And a drunk comes in and the group gives him one of them IBM cards, you know. And he fills it out. You ever see a shaking drunk try to fill out one of them things? If it ain't got holes, it'll have holes. And here. And then we've got IBM cards for every one of our members. And tonight, when the meeting's over, the secretary is going down to IBM place, and we're going to take all these cards, your card and all of our members, and we're going to drop them in there, and there's two going to come out the bottom. yours and the one who's going to be your sponsor, we're going to match y'all's profiles up. Well, it sounds logical, doesn't it? But the problem is this. The time they drop the cards up to the bottom and it comes down to the top, down to the bottom, the one who is chosen to be the monkey's sponsor could be drunk. So you can't computerize it. Ours is a highly personal touch and feel. Some drunks you talk to, you can talk nice and quiet. Some you have to holler at, some you have to cuss at, and some you have to take a baseball bat and beat them in the head to get their attention. And by action of a group, we find we do need some organization. You know, if somebody, you know, if nobody gets up the program, what's the result? If nobody makes a coffee, what's the result? Nobody answers a phone, answers a literature request or the mail? No. So in order to avoid such a disaster, one or more members is either agrees to be responsible, or they're elected, or they're requested, or they're appointed, or you better. And so all the way from coffee brewers to our general service board, those of us who take part in AA service work are assuming responsibility, not authority. And so as a result of it, this is a highly, highly, and if you're going to pay them a decent wage. And then if they don't do the job, you can fire them. But if you ask a member and say, well, you're retired and you're rich and you ain't got nothing to do, and why don't you come down here and open up and answer the phone and order the literature and count some money and go to the bank. Are they requested? Are they appointed? Are you better? And so all the way from coffee brewers to our general service board, those of us who take part in AA service work are assuming responsibility, not authority. And so as a result of it, this is a highly, highly, and if you're going to pay them a decent wage, and then if they don't do the job, you can fire them. But if you ask a member and say, well, you're retired and you're rich and you ain't got nothing to do, and why don't you come down here and open up and answer the phone and order the literature and count the money and go to the bank, look what a tremendous job it'll do for you. But the rest of them say, ain't it great? We gonna get it cheap. We don't have to pay nothing. And then the first time he makes a mistake on the deposit, and the first time he forgets to pay the light bill, and they come in or the rent, and the meeting, and the doors is locked, and somebody says, well, get rent. Wait a minute. He's doing it for nothing. And after all, don't be too hard on him. He's liable to get drunk. But you see, whether you're an alcoholic sober or not, and you're working at a real definite job, and the job is from 8 to 5, whether it's in a service office in here or in New York, and you don't produce, and your work progress is not satisfactory, then they can fire you. Just like any job. Like any job. And that's the difference in the way we used to operate and the way we operate today. Tradition 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be brought into public controversy. We think that the future safety of Alcoholics Anonymous greatly depends upon Tradition 10, AA's principle of no controversy to public will. Since AA began, AA has never been divided by a major controversial issue, and by some deep instinct, we have known from the very beginning that no matter what the provocation, AA itself, that is the name Alcoholics Anonymous, should never publicly take sides in any fight, even a worthy one. We must remember, however, this reluctance to fight one another or anybody else is not a special virtue which makes us feel superior to other people, nor does it mean that the members of AA who have been and are and will be restored as citizens of the world, that we're going to back away from our individual responsibility to act as we see fit on the right upon issues of our time, to vote as we see fit, only as individuals. But when it comes to AA as a whole, that's a different matter. Alcoholics Anonymous does not enter into public controversy because we know our fellowship will die if we do. We survive and grow and spread because we know that Alcoholics Anonymous is something of greater importance than any weight that we could collectively throw back at any cause. Recovery from alcoholism, which is life for us, and we wish to preserve its full strength because it's our only means of survival. This last house on the block, baby, where are we going? Where are we going to go? Now, the Washingtonian Society, a movement among alcoholics which started in Baltimore over a century and some odd years ago, almost found the answer to alcoholism. At first, the society was composed purely of alcoholics trying to help one another. And just in a few years, they grow to be 200,000-300,000. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous over 17 and a half years ago or whatever it was, they estimated there were 350,000 members of AA in the United States and Canada, and yet the Washingtonians in 2 or 3 years got up as high as 300,000-400,000. Now, had they stuck to their one goal, they might have found the full answer. Instead, the Washingtonians permitted politicians and reformers, both alcoholics and non-alcoholics, to use the society for their own purposes. They took violent sides on slavery issues. They even put out pamphlets. And some became temperance crusaders. Now, ain't that a kick? An alcoholic becoming a temperance crusader. Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if you go to AA a lot, but I'll tell you what. You know what's the most nauseating member of AA? The most nauseating member of AA is that self-righteous, religious, sober alcoholic. And nauseating, you know? And here they became temperance union leaders and everything, reformers, and they allowed both alcoholic and non-alcoholics to use the society for their own purposes. And guess what? Within a few years, they completely lost their effectiveness in helping alcoholics, and the society collapsed. And our Tradition 10 is based basically on the mistakes that the Washingtonians made. And so you see, in AA, we're not incorporated as a legal instrument with which to attack anybody, no matter how severe the provocation. We believe, since AA's inception and up to now, that AA is a fellowship and not an organization. Incorporation necessarily makes an organization. And you know, years ago, there was a tremendous alcoholic. Annie knew him. Some of you may have known him by the name of Bob Thompson. Bob was a federal judge from Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi. Bob was a delegate to the General Service Congress, one of the finest legal minds, drunk or sober. And when he became up to that conference as a delegate, they thought about incorporating AA, the name Alcoholics Anonymous. Just AA. And so they asked Bob with his legal mind if he would chair a committee and pick his men, so he got a fellow by the name of Willard Pegg. Willard's dead too. Willard, very personal friend of mine. And they was on when the conference started the next day, they said, well, did you come up with anything? He says, no, gentlemen. And this went on, and they said Friday, and the conference would break up on Saturday. And they said, Bob, have you come up with anything about incorporating AA? He said, I'll let you know Saturday morning. Saturday morning said, Bob, did you come up about incorporating AA? And Bob got up and he said, my members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I need to ask you but one question. How can you incorporate God? And the question never came up again about incorporating AA. We have to remember, now, listen to me carefully. If one does read the service manual, and one does read the General Service Board and its incorporation as bylaws, it'll answer a lot of your questions about why is it that certain fellowships can use our 12 steps. And it says this, that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous belong to all mankind. The 12 steps belong to all mankind, rather. But the minute you put the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the two words, alcoholic, then reprint permission has to be asked for because of a copyright violation. But you see, because the 12 steps, what are they? It's nothing more than God as we understood it. You take that out, you take God out of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have no recovery program. Our power greater than oneself. And so, but our corporate entities, that's another matter altogether. Tradition 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And I want to remind you something. And hey, we ain't got but three absolutes. Absolute abstinence from alcohol. The absolute freedom for any alcoholic to be a member of AA and leave AA. And absolute anonymity on the public media. This is the only tradition where it doesn't say you ought to. It says we need always. You don't have to have too many study groups about the word always. Always maintain anonymity, level of trust, rate, don't feel. Now, you say, well, why isn't TV on there? Well, our conference is real fussy about changing anything that Bill wrote. And actually, films is still video anyway, so it really doesn't make a difference. Now, the alcoholic who has and is recovering through our program is himself or herself the strongest attraction that AA has. When most people asked to let them seek AA help, the answer given, even though more and more are coming from us from treatment modalities, alcohol still today, it brings the greatest percentage of alcoholics to AA. It just throws them in there. And if you listen to what alcohol tells you when it throws you into AA, you know what it tells you? Buster, you better stay in there because you poke your head out, it'll kill you. Well, but when you ask, a lot of the members would ask them to seek AA help, the answer given most, and a lot of times is the AA member. Now, our chances would be slim if all of us had remained completely in hiding. But many of us have chosen to tell our friends, our physicians, our clergymen, our employers, our neighbors, our co-workers that we are an AA, and when we do that, we are not. Breaking our anonymity in the meaning of this tradition. Now, suppose a sick alcoholic who never had the good fortune to meet AA, how's he going to find us? And his or her search will be difficult if the local group thinks it should be autonomous, too. Now, the tradition is talking about personal anonymity, remember? No alcoholic will be attracted to AA if he or she doesn't know that it exists, or if he or she has a distorted, unfavorable impression of its members and its program. This is the reason we have our TV spots on television and our radio spots. You betcha. Giving the general public an accurate picture of AA is the chief job of public information committees. In addition, they carry the message to certain groups, from policemen to personnel directors, whose work, and physicians, whose work includes frequent contact with active alcoholics. Now, information about AA is being offered to the public through all the communication media, in print and over the air. Now, on radio, it's easy to guard a member's anonymity. But TV, which was not in wide use when this was written, that's another matter. And according to our conference experience, a member is violating his or her anonymity when he or she is identified on TV as an AA and his face is shown whether or not his or her name is given, and yet with this medium, with its vast audience, cannot be ignored. I'm going to share two actual experiences of my own, one on radio and one on television. I was on one of those talk shows, you know, where they call in, and they're on about 3 or 4 hours, and they always say they call in, you know, on radio, and I never changed my name, you know. I just say I'm David, but I don't tell them how I make a living or anything else or where I live, just a member of AA, and they usually have a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, and then they'll have a moderator, or usually the announcer, and they'll call in, and every kook in the world calls in. Some are not kooky, with some reasonably lucid questions. You got a drunk calls in every now and then. Hey, it didn't work for me, and all this and all that. And so I'm on there, and, you know, and at about 11:30 at night, and there's always some little kid supposed to be sleeping, and he wasn't sleeping, he's listening to radio. And so about 11:45, he runs into his mama's bedroom, and he wakes her up and says, Mama, wake up! Our dentist is on the radio, and he's a drunk. And he recognized my voice. And about 3 weeks later, that little monster had an appointment with me. And his mother brought him in, and she looked at me, and she said, Doctor, she said, how long have you been a member of AA? At the time, I was sober over 10 years. She says, you know, my father passed away last year, and he was sober 19 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But it's easy on radio to do it, as long as the full name isn't given, and, you know, where they can tell who you are. Now, and on television, not this last election, but the one before that. Not the 2 elections ago, when it was right after the Nixon debacle. Strike that from the name TV, that name. But anyway, it was one of those presidential elections. And because we don't get into those kind of things, really, and those go get taped out, you know, and this the word. And so, but you can put this part on, it don't make any difference. And anyway, and so because a lot of people have heard this, and so I got up that morning, nobody knew who's going to be the president. And I go down to the barbershop every Wednesday morning, and I got to be down there at 8, I get up about 6 o'clock, and here's my bedroom television, so I turn the television on, there's a wall, and behind the wall is a bathroom, big long mirror. And I'm in there, and I got the lather on my face, and I got my razor ready, and right as I'm getting ready to come down, I hear this voice on television says, "When your husband was drinking, he must have been an incorrigible, ugly drunk." And this other voice said, "You're being very kind when you even describe him in that manner." And I put the razor down, and I looked in the mirror, and I said, "David, you have not had a drink of alcohol this morning since you got up, but you are hearing two voices. One is a strange voice, and one is very familiar. One voice sounds like your wife." So I stuck my head around there, and there, my wife's back of her head, you know, with the shadow method, the head, back of the head, and this announcer on television, full face, and they're discussing me. So I run into her bathroom. Now, we've been married long enough and are old enough to have separate bedrooms, so it's okay. And I run in there to see if she's in her bed, and her bed is made up, nobody in there, and I run back, and there she is, out of the voice, and I'm building up a tremendous resentment. So I go down, and I park in the hotel parking lot, and as soon as I get in the parking lot, the manager says, "Hi, good morning, Doc. Son, heard your wife on television this morning." And I go in the barbershop, the manicurist, the boot black, the guy, everybody, Dad. And I'm building up a tremendous resentment. I get out to my office and call my wife up. I said, "Grace." I says, "You know, I watched you for a little while on television this morning, and see, their traditions are the same as ours, basically, as far as that is. And I said, you were just right. You had the back of your head. Nobody knew it. But see, she used another name. She didn't use Grace. She used another name. But I said, Grace, I have a tremendous resentment." She said, "What's that?" I says, "Of all the names you had to use, why'd you have to use the name of the woman that you accused me of getting locked up with the last time I got drunk?" And she said, "That's what's called live and let live, Buster." You know? But you see, you know, and oh, she didn't violate her anonymity, and I think everybody in the country saw that, you know, at that time. It just happened to be one of those things. And, but, you know, now you say, well, what about these so-called celebrities, quote, that are on television full face? Now, if you really want to see one of the best, you won't be able to see it because it happened 2 years ago. But the finest way to be on television that I have ever seen, AA or non-AA, occurred right before the Super Bowl game when it was played up north. And they had a member of Gamblers Anonymous on television. That was absolutely the best that I have ever seen. Now, they had worked the format out with our office. And they had been up there together with some television people to be sure that the format was. But that's the best that I've ever seen as far as the lighting goes and for the mass media and exposure that it came along about that time. And we have that. Now, the best way not to violate your anonymity on the public media is don't get up on the public media. But we see them all the time, and they you know, and most of them. Now, you know, they never have just a mill of a drunk that's been sober 40 years on there. They usually have a toe dancer or an athlete, because you have to remember, we're not the only, you know, us people in AA, we're not the only ones that are hounded by sick emotions and screwy behavior. The whole world's full of them. And, you know, they got a lot of sick folks out there that ain't alkies, you know, and they still have hero worship. There's nothing wrong with it. They have hero worship, and they build monuments and medals, you know, and all this kind of thing, and statues. And so when a celebrity gets on, you know, oh, isn't that nice, you know? But let's talk about a couple of real celebrities now, Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll never hear about them unless we talk about them. Down in West Texas, there was a drunk by the name of Horace F., and Horace had, he's dead, but Horace was a son of a Methodist minister, and he was a bad alcoholic, and he was later chairman, I mean, they had superintendent of a large school system, but due to his alcoholism and his actions, he was fired, and he ended up down with Skid Row. And he was down in the Del Rio section down in through that part of the country. And back into that part of the world, back through there to where they have got nothing but 900,000 goats and 900 million sheep and cactus and rocks, and in the Big Bend country, and maybe about God knows very few people, and he runs across a Mexican sheep herder, and Horace could speak fluent Spanish. So he said, what do you want to do about your drinking? And he got to talking to him. And you know, a sheep herder out there, or a goat raiser out there, you ask him, what do you want to do about your drinking? You know, they'll say, why? Because ain't nothing there but goats and sheep and cactus and rocks and ain't no people. And so he said, wait a minute, I've got a friend on the next ranch, he's a worse drunk than me. So Horace and him go over and they net the other one, and they get a group going. And Horace stays with him for about 3.5 weeks, and this is before the big book was translating Spanish, and he read the big book to him, and they took their 4-step with him, they took their 5th step with him, they did the steps with him, the men's steps they couldn't do, and he wrote little things in Spanish for them to keep, and off went. Well, every day of the year, those two got together and had an AA meeting. And then here come another one, and they grabbed their 4 or 5, you know, and then one of them moved 60 miles away, 120 miles away, rather, to the east. So 5 days a week, those two would drive 60 miles toward the center, one to the 60 miles to the west, other to the east, they would meet. By this time, the big book was in Spanish, and the 12-12 was in Spanish. And other little literature they'd get from over in Puerto Rico or South or Central America, wherever they could find it. And they'd have a meeting, and they'd bring their lunch, and they'd have a 2-hour meeting, and they'd go back. Well, some years ago, one of them died, and he was 28 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous without a hitch. And then 3 years later, the other one died, and he was sober 31 years in Alcoholics Anonymous without a hitch. Now, let me tell you about those two men. When they were buried, they didn't have, in the little towns they were in, they didn't have a church auditorium big enough, a school gymnasium or school auditorium big enough. They had to hold their services for both of them in the football field so they'd get all the people in there, and they come from miles around. And they had little kids that used to call them Grandpa. And others used to come, they used to call them Daddy. And God, those two men, they worked with drunks like you've never seen them, and they directed the family to Al-Anon and everything else. And the greatest compliment that any human being could ever receive from his fellow man, that the two ministers that administered the last rites said for both of them, it says, these two men, individually, they went about doing good. And they were absolutely a joy. Many, many, many families and many, many homes in that whole countryside and many groups got started as a result of those two fellows. Now, that's a real celebrity. They didn't get up on a public television and say, see how great I am, now sign me to a new movie contract. Or I've got a new record coming out. Or I've got to pay my coke dealer. And I ain't talking about Coca-Cola either. Here are two people who fell in love with life living sober as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Language is no barrier. Education was no barrier. They were just common earth people. But they did the deal. And that's just the way it is. And AA is full of them. And so as a result of it, because we see that anonymity is a protective cloak that covers our whole society. Yeah. Sure. Where would we be today if Henrietta Seiberling hadn't said to Bill Wilson, Bill Wilson, I want you to meet Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith. He needs you and you need him. And we're here today as a result of it. Tradition 12, anonymity, the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality. We have to remember that anonymity, not taking credit for our own or anybody else's recovery, is humility at work. If I'm going to take credit for getting anybody sober, I better take credit if they get drunk again. Anonymity, as we observe it today, is the root, is a very simple expression of humility. When we use the 12 steps to recover from alcoholism, we're each trying to achieve real humility, to put our self-respect on a solid base of truth rather than on fantasies about ourselves. When we use our 12 traditions to work together in AA, we're all trying to achieve real humility as individual members by recognizing our true place in AA as a fellowship, by recognizing AA's true place in the world. Tradition 1 just simply reminds each of us that we're not recovering on our own. and that we should control our personal desires and ambitions in order to guard the unity of our group and our fellowship. We ought not. Tradition 2, imagine or fancy ourselves as big shots in AA. No matter what service office any of us are allowed to serve. All of us are just alcoholics together in our groups. We're not entitled, Tradition 3, to rule on the qualifications of other alcoholics seeking the same help that we have had. One of the best ways to become all-inclusive in AA is just be an AA. Differences separate us. That means that I'm different. I got to have a different program than you, you know. But it takes time. Love them. Hug them. You know. And it really works real good. Yeah. We get all exercised, you know, about things that we don't need to. We get what we call mental hernias. And that usually causes, that's what you call a strain on an immature mind. And so we're not recovering on our own. And we can't rule on the qualifications of other alcoholics seeking the same help that we've had. Yet a group needs humility too. One of the biggest problems, I'm going to stop right here and share some experience, and this is experience, not opinion. You see, members get very sensitive when they're criticized because they say something other than they're an alcoholic. And they don't believe that we really accept them. We do. The problem is they don't believe us. And so they got a cause. And by the same token, the one that says we believe, they got a cause too. And so when that happens, you got friction in between. And where do the principles go? Then the personalities get involved. You know? So it really doesn't make any difference for this alcoholic, you know. I mean, I love you. And whether you love me or not, I have no control over it. If it did, everybody in AA would love me. But they ain't supposed to. Because we've got to have those differences. Because there ain't no two people exactly alike in this world. If there were, one would be useless. And it's the individual freedom that I talked about, the beginning, and we talked about, is the most precious thing we've got, and we've got to not defend it. You don't have to defend anything. We don't have to defend anything now that we're sober in AA. We just live it, that's all. And allow to love and to grow and to love and to share and to care. And it's a wonderful experience. It certainly is. And as a result of we don't have to worry about classify an alcoholic to seek the help we've had. Now, it may, a group has to have humility too. It may make its name public, but in the spirit of anonymity. It should see that whatever group is merely a part of the bigger whole, Tradition 4, careful in every enterprise to consider the welfare of all the other groups that make up AA. In both group and individual activity, we should remember what the full name of our fellowship is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. It does not represent any established religion, nor is it a new religion. We're not evangelists, gurus, or temperance leaders out to save humanity. We're just simply anonymous alcoholics trying to help other alcoholics, Tradition 5. In the rising battle against alcoholism, we ought not to let our pride in AA mislead us into linking our fellowship with other agencies in order to bid for a share of their power, prestige, and money. And if we keep Tradition 6 and 7 in mind, we will instead direct all our efforts towards AA's own unique purpose. When we go on a 12-step call or we sit and we work with alcoholics, we should not tell ourselves how noble we are for doing such valuable work without pay. The meaning of our 12-step work cannot be measured in money, Tradition 8. We have received advance pay for it in money far greater of any worth, and that's our very lives ourselves. In the same tradition, it is suggested that service centers maintain AA humility by paying its employees decent wages, rather than considering AA so virtuous an outfit that employment there is a favor. And when we're given special responsibilities within AA, Tradition 9 defines these as opportunities to serve, not titles to flaunt in each other's faces. The humility of the fellowship itself is safeguarded by tradition 10 with the refusal to set ourselves up as general authorities, swinging and throwing our collective weight around in the public's business. And we do not want to sell our program as a surefire remedy in the extravagant turn of promotional campaign. Tradition 11. Nor do we wish to dramatize it by identifying noted people in AA, thereby implying that for each of us, our sobriety has been an individual accomplishment. And Tradition 12 reminds us that we have something far stronger than our human responsibility to fall back on. Our principles come first. They are not of our own invention. They reflect eternal spiritual values. And so with this tradition, both as individuals and as a fellowship, we humbly acknowledge our dependence on a power greater than ourselves. I want to thank you for your attention and for your attendance. And you've given far more to me than I could possibly give to you by just sitting there. Thank you very, very much. I mean,
has anybody here got any questions for David that they'd like to ask?
Well, that is a common use, that profanity. I've been up here since 1 o'clock, right? And I don't believe that you've heard heck and shoot and darn, but you haven't heard, pardon the expression, damn or even hell, have you? It can be done. Now, I didn't used to do that, but I was nailed by some sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous who told me that if I wanted associated with the successes in AA, that my language had to get cleaned up too at that time. Now, I realize that, there is a lot of it in AA today, but, ego causes us to say a lot of things a lot of times to impress somebody how tough we are. But basically, it also reveals how ignorant we are. And, a lot of times, the language, there is a lot of it in there, and, sometimes it gets to be very offensive. And you hear a lot of it, and they're not told. They don't know any different. And it comes as a result of, this is not critical, but this is my own experience. Sponsorship also has a lot to do with how people conduct themselves and how they talk. I personally don't feel that language is necessary to express anything. That's my own personal belief. However, it is not as prevalent as it used to be. Maybe in some areas it there really is. But you see, we can't control anybody's behavior in AA. We can't control their language. We can lead by example. And there are a lot of groups who have suffered some very severe consequences because they've lost a lot of their good members who no longer go to that deal. And those, usually, who use that kind of language haven't got the money to continue to support those expensive places that they've got to pay rent on. You know? Yeah. I know what you mean. But there's nothing in there. That has to come with growth and love and understand them and love them. And it's pretty tough when they start using those four-letter words over and over and over and over again. It really is. And yet, you know, it's an amazing thing. The thing and I've been to a lot of them that have been that way, and I just blot it out. But what concerns me as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is when we invite ministers and police chief and lawyers and non-alcoholics in the community to come to an open meeting, and you get some monkey up that uses every four-letter word in the deal, and they say, my God, they talk about God in 1 minute and fornication in the other. What is this? Where our open meetings, that's a showcase of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? I'm talking about using the words of fornication at the same time. And they say, well, that's a showcase of AA, to where it's open to the public to come and see. So the best solution I have found in my own personal life, my own experiences, I just love them, you know. And I do with them with what's been done with me. I says, you know, is it really necessary? And I said, what's it got to do with you staying sober? And 9 out of 10 times they say nothing, and I just walk away, and they usually get the message, you know. But love them. You know, they don't know any difference. They got to grow. And a lot of times they don't realize they're doing it themselves until you say something to them. Some are going to get a little angry, but that's all right. And also, when they find out they're not asked to talk very much anymore, they get the message a heck of a lot quicker. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Some groups, you know, they put on there absolutely no cussing. That invites the first one up there to test it. No defense is the best defense. That's always been AA's deal. They certainly, it takes care of itself. It eliminates.
I want to thank David for coming and talking to us this afternoon.
He's great.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.